Retro Gaming Radio 2003. Keep it retro.
Wait a minute. This all happened before.
Yeah, this does seem really familiar.
Retro Gaming Radio 2004. Keep it retro.
Prepare to qualify.
Keep it retro.
Hello, folks. Welcome to the September 2003 edition of Retro Gaming Radio. This is Shane R. Monroe, your host, with Brian Smith behind the mixing board. Welcome to the program. We have an incredibly busy, long show for you this month. We feature interviews with Howard Scott Warshaw and Bill Kunkel. I'm going to have our regular bits and bytes. We're going to take a mini review of the new Tron 2.0 video game. Modern game with classic theme. Does it hold up to the Shane R. Monroe Challenge? Well, we're going to take a look at that. And, of course, we have the regular editorial commentary as well as some more good stuff, so stick around. We're going to keep the rant relatively short this month just because we have so much crap to cover and such a long show to run anyway. I'm going to kind of keep this short. There's been a bunch of discussion on the forums. I'd like to kind of publicly talk about it here on the show because I think it's important, and we as a community need to make sure that crap like this doesn't happen. I'm a computer gamer, okay, for the most part. You know, I've got a Dreamcast, I've got a PlayStation, but I am a computer gamer. And, as you know, the console wars can wage all they want. You know, if Xbox wants to hold exclusivity over Sony, over Nintendo, and all that other crap, and they want to pay each other off to get title exclusivity so that they can fuel their loser console, that's fine. You know, there was a movie that basically gang members were killing each other in the street, and the cop said, as long as they keep shooting the right people, I don't give a rat's ass. And that's the way I feel about consoles. You know, if Sony wants to eliminate Microsoft or whatever, hey, you know, I'm all for it. Because you know what? That does not affect me. I'm a computer gamer. I am happy that Tron 2.0 came out on the PC. Otherwise, I may never get it. It would have been an Xbox exclusive or something. Well, I guess what I'm trying to say here is that as long as the console wars stay on the console turf, I don't care what they do. I don't care if they hold Vice City off from running on the Xbox. I don't care if they hold Knights of the Old Republic off from running on the Sony PlayStation 2. Frankly, I don't care. But recently, Microsoft added to their list of things I'd rather see them hanging on a cross for than not. They paid off LucasArts, and this is from Computer Gaming World. If you guys really want the source, I'm sure I can get it. Basically, Microsoft paid off LucasArts to keep Knights of the Old Republic not off the Sony PlayStation 2, not off of the Nintendo GameCube, but off of the PC. As far as I'm concerned, that's treading where Microsoft does not belong, okay? That is skirting the concept of breaking the law. That's not preventing your competitors through exclusivity, all right? The PC should not be considered a competitor for the Xbox, unless, of course, the Xbox is really a PC like we've been saying all along. Maybe that's what Microsoft's admitting to. We can't play. We're so worried about playing not only in the console field, but now we have to compete against the PC people because basically what we do is produce PC games. Maybe that's what that boils down to. What pisses me off is I don't like the fact that the console wars are bleeding over into my home turf, which is computer gaming. And there's absolutely no good reason why it should be. If you want to pay off to keep Sony from getting a copy of it or from getting GameCube to getting a copy of it, I'm all for that. What I'm not for is for you to leave your area and come and piss in my pool, which is the PC gaming pool. I think that's going too far. And I think you're going to see a lot more of this crap. If you think that this little stunt isn't going to be followed up with something bigger, you know, you obviously don't know Microsoft intimately like we do over here. Okay? Microsoft is already basically saying they're going to put sports games out of business by releasing their own Microsoft sports line. Now, don't think that they aren't going to do everything in their power to product dump or do whatever it is that Microsoft does, pay people off, go Gestapo style, to make their sporting game lineup the top of the line. So much for Sega, which, poor Sega, you know, they haven't been able to hold their own anyway. And who wouldn't like to see Electronic Arts, you know, knock down a few notches? But not at the expense of Microsoft getting the lead. I'll pass. I'd rather have EA in charge, and that says a lot. This stuff is getting out of hand, folks, and it's starting to bleed into territories where it shouldn't be. Keep that in mind next time you think Microsoft's a good people that are living by the bounds of business rules. Because I think that they're slowly slipping farther and farther away in no man's land, places they shouldn't be. And, you know, frankly, it's starting to worry me. Pretty soon you're going to have to buy a console if you want to play games, because they're going to lock out all the PC stuff. Now, that won't be any fun, will it? Unless, of course, I guess you're a console lover, then I guess that's just cast me out for you. But for us PC people, watch your back, folks, because the chickens are coming home to roost, and they're Microsoft chickens, MS Chickens 1.0. If you don't know the name Howard Scott Warshaw, then you definitely know his games. Whether it be the entirely too questionable E.T. for the 2600, or be it the Great Yars Revenge for the 2600, or even the Immortal Raiders of the Lost Ark for the 2600, you've played the games, you know his work. We caught up with Howard Scott Warshaw for many hours at the Classic Gaming Expo 2003. The man, of course, is a wealth of information, as almost all of our interviewees are, and let's find out what he had to say. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Howard Scott Warshaw. Folks, this is Shane R. Monroe at the Classic Gaming Expo 2003 in Las Vegas, Nevada. I am here with the man, the myth, the legend, someone you have all heard about, but we've never had on the show, Howard Scott Warshaw.
Yeah, thank you, Shane.
For those of you who may have been living under a rock, Howard Scott Warshaw was responsible for Yars Revenge, which, again, if you don't know what Yars Revenge is, you shouldn't be listening to this show anyway.
Now, people living in Iraq probably haven't seen much of these games.
They might actually have it brand new now. I heard that they were running some sort of a 2600s for Iraq thing. Shipping over food and Iraq cartridges for Iraq.
Do you remember that commercial? They have it on the internet where the coming soon games and it's
yeah.
That's what they're running in Iraq right now.
That's everyone's playing Yars Revenge.
It's Yars Revenge and ET.
Yars Revenge between Iraq and a hard place. Yeah.
Though folks may also not know that you also did Raiders of the Lost Ark and, of course, the infamous 2600 ET.
The infamous, indeed.
Which we will be talking lots about that. Give us a little background about Howard Scott Warshaw, the developer.
Well, Howard Scott Warshaw, the developer, is a guy who is just totally committed to turning out creative product. That's all I can do. When I got to Atari, it was really cool, because there was a place where I had to make creative technical production, and that was my job. And that was great, and I loved that. And after I left that, for the rest of my career, which was all over the place, I mean, I've had a real estate broker's license, you know, I've worked in industrial robotics, I've done compilers, networks, photography, videography,
wow.
Had a few documentaries on PBS, I've done all kinds of stuff, but whenever I'm working at a job that is not sufficiently creatively taxing, I just do my own creative projects on the side, because I always have to be making something creative, and that's, you know, if you want to talk about who's Howard Scott Warshaw, that's the essence of it, is, you know, I'm someone who needs to make a creative product.
That's good, that's good. We relate a lot to that. Are you making product now? I mean, are you still able to... How do you exercise your creative demons now in a generation where creativity is definitely not on the agenda?
You know, that's increasingly true. Creativity does not seem to be the main reward, but you see little spots of it here and there.
Here and there you do.
So I do what I can. I mean, most recently, what product I've been working on is my DVD for Once Upon Atari.
So I don't know. Give us a lot more information about that.
Well, if your viewers have heard about it, it's a documentary series about behind the scenes at Atari, what it was really like for us making the games, doing the outrageous things that we did, which we did. And it was like we were making a lot of money, having a lot of fun, being able to do whatever we wanted to do. I mean, whatever we wanted to do, as long as we could put games out. And so we did. We did some pretty outrageous things. We took advantage of a situation that was just right.
Now, and back then, to clue in the listeners, you guys pretty much had carte blanche over what you did. Marketing didn't tell you what to do. You weren't influenced by the last first-person shooter that came out. You guys had your own
deal. The whole goal was to make a new game, to find something fresh, something solid, a new play experience, which is almost the opposite of what's going on today.
Yeah.
In the last 4 years I've been in the industry, it's interesting. It's okay. You know, you can make some interesting stuff. But nobody wants to take the risk of creating something new.
And why do you think that is? Total, pure financial?
Oh, I think it's purely financial. It's Warshaw's law of marketing inversion. I invented this in college. Yeah, is that You know, the problem is the engineering resources grow arithmetically, but marketing and business, if it starts to be successful, grows geometrically.
Right.
So what happens is the budgets for marketing and sales and stuff grow way out of proportion to the engineering sales. So in the mind of anyone looking at a corporation, they'll see that there's so much more money going into marketing and sales in a successful company that they'll automatically start listening to them more, even though engineering is where the product is coming from.
Right.
So it just always grows disproportionately small in a successful company and loses control. And then, you know, they're not always wrong. You know, I mean, you know, these guys
want
to
minimize. There's always money to be made.
There's money to be made, and there's risk to minimize, I guess, is their thing.
Absolutely.
Now, I've never been a risk minimizer.
That's why you create some of the best games ever made. I think everyone would be in agreement with me when saying, you look at Yar's Revenge, that game has withstood the test of time. You can go down right now and buy an Atari 10-in-1 and play Yar's Revenge, brand new today.
That's cool. It's true. Yeah, and Yar's Revenge, you know, my whole goal with that was to make a game I wanted to play. That was my only goal. Originally, it was assigned to Star Castle, the Koinot game. It was supposed to be Star Castle. And I just took a look at it, and I went to Dennis Coble, who was the boss of VCS at the time, and said, you know, we could try to do this game, but, you know, it's going to really suck. And I said, I don't want to do a game that sucks. I said, you know, give me a couple of days. Let me rework this. And I sort of topologically reorganized what I felt were some of the components of the game, made up a few others, and put together the basics of what became Yars, although it wasn't Yars. The working title for it originally was Time Freeze.
Time Freaks?
Time Freeze.
Freeze, like, gotcha.
Cold Freeze.
Cold Freeze.
And the idea was that I wanted to have a payoff sequence. One thing I wanted to do in my game was to have a big payoff for whenever you did the master stroke, whatever the big thing is to do in the game.
Right.
I wanted to have a big payoff sequence, which no one had really ever done before in a game.
Sure.
Yar's Revenge had a lot of firsts.
Tell us about those.
Well, Yar's Revenge was the first game with a full screen explosion on the VCS. The first game with reset from the joystick.
I remember reading about that.
Another game had that. It was the first game Atari put out that had the name of the programmer published with the game.
Interesting.
It was the first game with an acknowledged Easter egg. Because I wanted to do all the things that I'd seen before. I wanted to do a few more new things. And I wanted to create policies in the company to open it up. I didn't want programmers to have to be on the sly behind the scenes trying to do little things, you know, that don't get the kind of promotion and publicity I felt could really carry a game. So Easter egging, you know, I certainly didn't invent Easter egging, but I took it to the next level of making it a corporate policy.
So there was actually a standing order to actually put Easter eggs in the games. Even if it
wasn't
official.
They were looking for it, and marketing approved it, whereas before they didn't want them.
Really?
Yeah, they said they were against them. The reason people used to put Easter eggs in originally,
right.
And the Easter egg was always the initials of the programmer, and there was one reason people used to put that in, and that was because they wanted to make sure you could always identify who the programmer was.
Why was Atari against letting the programmer be heard? Why were they against
that?
Well,
Atari's a corporation, right? And a corporation doesn't want stars. The corporation wants everyone to think, look at this great Atari game.
Right, they don't want to see Howard Scott Warsaw.
Right, look at a Howard Scott Warsaw game that Atari happened to release.
That's,
you know, that's not the image they want to see, because they want to protect their own investment, right? Because they also,
sure.
They don't want people from outside to have targets to go after.
I see, they didn't want people going after their talent.
Right, it's defense on their part. And it's like I said, a lot of these things, you know, people demonize. You know, the companies and stuff like that. And sometimes they're worth demonizing. But a lot of times, you know, they're just doing their thing. They're just, you know, behaving rationally. You just don't want to take their perspective because you're not used to it. But, you know, they play their game. We play ours.
What's the Easter egg in Yar's Revenge?
Well, Yar's Revenge, the Easter egg is called the Ghost of Yars. And what it is that after you kill the Kotal in midair and you're in the middle of the full screen explosion, you'll see a streak. You'll see a streak running down the screen, a black line. And if you get down on the third quarter down the screen of that line, if you're touching that at the end of the explosion, your game will freeze and it'll come up and it'll say HSWWSH. Okay, and that's a code, because that's my initials and my initials backwards. And what that code means is that if you really want to know the story of Yar's Revenge, what you have to do is spell Yar backwards. And Yar backwards is red. And Yar's Revenge takes place in the Razak solar system. But if you spell Razak backwards, that's Kazar. Ray Kazar was the CEO of Atari at the time.
And wow.
That gets into a story. It's kind of a cool story about how I sort of outmarketed marketing in terms of getting Yar's Revenge to be Yar's Revenge. Because originally they didn't know what it was going to be, and they were just going to pick some name and market it. And I didn't want to leave that to marketing because I was not that impressed at that time. With the people and what they were coming up with. I didn't feel they were very creative. So what I did was I wrote a story. Because I thought, you know, and Yar's Revenge was also another first for Yar's Revenge. the first game published with an auxiliary booklet and a whole story behind the game, as opposed to just a one-paragraph blurb of the background of the game. What I did to market Yar's Revenge within the company was, first I thought up this whole thing with Yars and Ray Kazar and stuff, and I wrote a science fiction story. I wrote this whole story explaining the background of Yars, which was sort of dumbed down and then published in the comic book. And what I did was, and so I called a marketing guy and said, hey, you know, what's up? I said, you guys got a name for the game yet? They go, no. I said, well, I'd like to make a submission. I said, is that okay? He goes, oh, yeah, that's fine, no problem. I said, cool. I said, you know, I said, I got a thing. I said, I got a story and a name for it and stuff. He goes, fine. He comes over to pick it up. I said, cool. So I gave it to him, and then I waited until the next day, and he was running around the lab. I said, hey, is that name in for submission? He goes, yeah. I said, they made a decision yet? He goes, no. And I said, look, I said, I don't want to influence the decision-making process here in any way. I said, but you know what? I said, I got to tell you a secret. You know, and I swore the guy to secrecy. I said, you got to promise me you will not tell anyone what I'm about to tell you, because I don't want this to affect anything. And he goes, yeah. I said, you swear you won't tell anyone? He goes, yeah, I swear. So at this point, I know he's going to tell everyone.
Absolutely. Yeah, exactly.
So,
yeah.
And so, okay.
That's how you make people swear.
So I told him, I said, okay, look, you know Yar? He goes, yeah. I said, spell it backwards. He goes, Ray. Yeah, that's right, Ray. I said, and look at Rayzak solar system, right? He goes, Kazar. Oh, Ray Kazar. I said, exactly. He goes, does Ray Kazar know about this? I said, yeah, that's why you can't tell anybody. I said, I told Ray about this, and Ray's cool with it. I said, but, you know, just play it through and see how you like it and stuff, you know, and that's it, that's okay. And he goes, all right. And so it's like, so he took off. Now, Kazar didn't know a thing about this.
Right.
Didn't know anything about this. But I knew, I just knew in my heart of hearts that nobody in marketing is going to have the balls to talk to Ray anyway. They're just too intimidated by him. So I just figured, they'll spread this around. You know, no one will say anything to Ray. And then wham, they'll just approve this one magically and whammo. And so he comes back like the next day. He goes, guess what? He goes, we're going with yours. We're going with the story. He goes, it's great. We love the story and stuff like that. I said, that's cool. That's cool. And sweet. You didn't tell anybody, did you? Oh, no. I didn't say anything. Yeah.
That's classic.
Then a few months later, I saw Ray Kazar at a press thing or whatever,
oh, no.
And he ultimately had heard. And so he comes up to me like with this kind of face. He's like, you know, Howard, I heard about that little Yars thing you pulled before. I said, yeah.
Damn.
How'd you like that, Ray? You know, he goes, why don't you just keep making better games?
Oh, man.
But he was like joking with it and stuff. He was cool. He was giving me a little shot, but, you know,
that's
good. Ray was a weird guy, but he was an interesting guy.
So from a technical standpoint, what was Yars Revenge like to code?
Yars Revenge was interesting because it was my first game.
Well, Yars Revenge was your first game.
Oh, yeah. And I just I learned the machine, sat down, just read the manual, started looking at a little bit other people's code, got a few advice from a few other people. Then I started coding away. I mean, just because it was more... The 2600 was an amazing technical challenge. There's no question about it. It's a very brutal, aggressive technical challenge. But the key thing to remember with it was that it's not a programming job.
Right.
It's a game making. It's an entertainment job. There were a lot of people there who made really crappy games, I think, you know, because they would tell you how great their code was, how slick their code was, what cool stuff they did. You know, you say, well, but look what you did with it. You know, the point
you
is...
You did nothing.
Yeah, nobody's trying to get cool code. People want a fun game.
Absolutely.
And so, you know, I tried to pride... I mean, I did a few, I thought, cool techniques and stuff, like the snake in Raiders. I think it's kind of a cool effect.
That's a very cool effect.
And it's a real snake. You know, it holds its position on the screen. It slithers around and stuff. And there was, you know, these CT flies. I animated some things. In fact, I put out a memo. I used to put out memos at Atari explaining technical little things we could do, techniques, things like that. But the key was, what are you doing with the game? I mean, are you getting something, contributing to making a fun game? That, to me, was always the thing. And people who were just finding programming techniques that were like, oh, I could do this in 30 cycles. You know, or I could do this way. Some of those were cool, and they were interesting, you know.
From an engineering standpoint, but not as a game player standpoint.
Exactly.
Do you see that is what's happening today? I mean, I look around, and that's one of the big bitches we have on this show, is about people who are building technical demos for video cards and putting a game name on them.
Well, I've never heard any big bitches on this show, but I'm glad to know you don't discriminate. Got to tell you. But, nowadays it's a whole different thing. Nowadays the technical stuff is brought to the fore. It is the important thing, okay, because there is no game-making process. If you really think about it today, people aren't making games. They're making knockoffs, and the only thing they can think to improve is the technical aspect. So they're definitely trying to get, you know, a little more pixel data, right? A little more photorealism into it, doing the same game they've been doing all along. They're trying to get more cutscenes into a game because they feel that enhances a game.
Right.
Well, it doesn't hurt a game, but I don't think they're improving games. I'll tell you what I think is very interesting. E3 this year. Okay, now last year, what's the big, by far game?
We actually stopped going to E3 because we were disgusted by the product.
I was
so we didn't go last year.
Well, that's good because you would have seen nothing.
Okay. But that's why we didn't go.
That's why I didn't see anything. I'm telling you. No, the thing is like GTA 3. Okay.
Now, I have to admit, I do like GTA 3.
I love GTA 3. I think that is a huge game. And that game sold unbelievable. Okay.
And it should have.
Absolutely, because that was the first game, I think, in quite a while that actually had some innovative design to it.
See, I'm not the only one that thinks this stuff.
Oh, it's a genius game, okay?
It is.
And here's the thing, it's like there's no real new mechanics in the game. Games aren't about mechanics, right?
No.
They're about organizing a style of play and a motivation
and
a goal.
Absolutely.
You know, GTA 3 opened up a world to you. It took 3D gaming and really made it 3D gaming as opposed to limited scenario 2D gaming with a 3D impression.
Right.
You know, it opened the world up. It lets you select your own missions, take the freedom you want in it. That was innovative game design, and you haven't seen that in a long time in the industry.
I completely agree.
Now, think of this. Now, here's the interesting perspective on this. Usually in this industry, you get a hit game and everybody jumps on it with both feet. Everybody rips it off. They knock it off because they can. Okay. GTA 3, though, the innovation in GTA 3 was conceptual. It was design innovation. The graphics were not spectacular.
Absolutely
not. And who cares? You know, the art was mediocre. And who cares? You know, I want to play a game. And I got over 100 hours out of that game.
Yeah, me too.
And I thought, you know, all right, I could pay full price for that game.
And I can walk away not feeling screwed.
50 cents an hour for my entertainment.
Yeah.
You know, that is
That's a good deal.
That's
a bargain.
Yeah, it's beautiful. And so the thing is, now I looked at E3 this year specifically to see, and no one's ripping off GTA 3. They're copying the theme a little bit here and there.
Right, like, what's that, State of Emergency, I think, is one that
State of Emergency was done a while ago, but there's, a lot of the EA games and stuff like that. They're basically, they still create their little scenario. They tell you it's a 3D game, but in GTA, you're in a 3D world. You go anywhere you want, anytime,
you
do whatever
you want.
Yeah, in the other games, you have a little scenario, you play that one out, then you get your next limited scenario. And the reason they limit the scenario is so you can pack more graphics data in a smaller area than if you have to cover a lot of graphics data in a larger area. So
absolutely.
Technically, you can do it. But what they can't seem to do is innovate design-wise. So when you come up with a GTA 3 where the real innovation is not the graphic technology...
Or the technology base in general.
Exactly. The real innovation is design. Well, oh my God, what are we going to do? Have to come up with something creative? They can't.
They can't.
Nobody can come up with a new game idea.
You know what I think it makes GTA 3 work? Is the fact that it's a multifaceted game in the way that if you've got 10 minutes to kill, you could drop in GTA 3, go on a massacre hunt, and turn it off and go away and not think... God, I wanted to finish that level. God, I wanted to finish that mission. But you can go in and just have a massacre and be happy with that.
Exactly. The way I put it is that game is totally accessible. Right?
Absolutely.
If you want to play for hours and hours, it'll keep you involved and there's major league stuff to do. If you want to just pop it in, like you just said, I mean, that's such a perfect example. Because some games have this barrier like, oh, I'd like to play a little game, but I don't have at least 20 or 30 minutes, so there's
absolutely.
No point in starting.
Absolutely.
GTA 3, not true.
We have a lot of arguments about that. In fact, with our intern over there, about games that require... He's like, well, you got to play it for an hour before you can get into it. Hell no, I ain't got no hour to sit and play this game for an hour just to find out, decide if I like it or to have it convince me to play it. I got 20 minutes. If I'm not hooked in 20 minutes, the game goes off. You know, and that's something that, like, from the old school days, Yar's Revenge, pick it up, and you're, you know...
Well, in the old school games, there wasn't an issue to it. The game had to be totally open and accessible. The games never approached the level of complexity you can get to today. Not everybody does, but you can.
But now Raiders of the Lost Ark. Now that was
fairly a departure.
That was pretty complex. Let's talk about that.
Okay, well, that's good because with Raiders, like, I have a motivation for every game. You know, every game I have a theme in my head that I want to accomplish. You know, with Yar's Revenge, that theme was I want to make a game that I want to play. With Raiders of the Lost Ark. Okay, so this is like the first adventure-style game that Atari is putting out since Adventure.
Now this was a licensed game.
How licensed?
Let's talk, while you're talking about that, kind of roll in. I mean, I'm assuming that somebody was sitting over your shoulder with the Raiders of the Lost Ark handbook saying...
Nobody
was doing that.
Oh, no, the only person who was really looking at the game was Spielberg. And that was cool.
I heard he's like not very happy to work with in a gaming environment.
Oh, I love him.
Really?
I thought he was great because I'd pitch him ideas, I'd lay it out there. He loved it.
He didn't like veto you.
No, well, he liked what I was presenting and stuff. His only suggestion was when I was looking, when I laid out the design for E.T., he goes, "Dan, you do something like Pac-Man."
Uh-oh.
And I just thought, holy Christ, I couldn't believe it.
What, he's going to pick up Reese's Pieces the whole time as he was running around?
I just wanted to tell him, you know, Steven, when you're going to do, you know, the next movie you're going to do, why don't you just do Close Encounters of the Third Kind again? It's like, it's like, you know.
Did that click with him?
That was weird.
Did he get that?
I didn't say that.
Oh, okay. I was just wondering, because I mean, I want to slap people around and say, we just did that.
Yeah, and you know, and in retrospect, though, you'd say, well, maybe it wasn't such a bad idea.
Well, yeah, we'll get to that later.
But E.T. will come to... So Raiders, the point is, I'm on the heels of Adventure. And Adventure was a huge, huge game.
Yes, it was.
And
it was very
totally
cool.
Respected that, okay? Warren Robinette did an amazing thing with Adventure, but it was very, very base level, right? It was an introduction to the concept of Adventure, but
absolutely,
it was very unelaborated, which things don't have to be too elaborate on 2600, but you can go a little farther.
Sure.
So my feeling was, if I'm going to put out an adventure game, I don't want it to just be, everyone goes, oh yeah, well this is like Adventure, only it's not Adventure.
This is Raiders of the Lost Ark running on the Adventure engine.
Yeah, no, this had to be a contribution. I wanted this to be a next step in adventure game.
Sure.
So I wanted to make the biggest game there was on the 2600, you know, just in terms of scope. So when someone thought of what the size of this whole game is, they just felt this is immense, much more than you ever expect.
Now, did you have more memory to work with on the cartridge at that time than Adventure did?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Adventure was done in 2K, and that wasn't a fair
comparison.
And
you had, what, 8K or 16?
I had 8K for Raiders, I'm pretty sure. And it was 4 or 8K, and I'm pretty sure it was 8K. Yours Adventure was 4K, Raiders was 8K. And I
8 kilobytes, folks, for those of you who aren't doing the math at home.
Oh, yeah, and that's not much. I mean, nowadays...
8 megs,
not
8
megs,
gigs.
Not 8 gigs, not 8 megabits.
No, 8,000 bytes. 8,000.
I mean, you could almost fit that on a business card.
That was your last email.
8,000, that's right, smaller than that.
Your last email was
8,192 bytes, and that's it.
Unbelievable. And I still can't believe that. And while we're on the subject, not to stray off, but the 2600 didn't have a lot of support stuff. It's not like you could just call a sound routine or anything like that. You guys actually did almost all of that stuff yourself.
No, it's all in line. Not only that, but of the screen time, every frame, you have 75% of that frame time is spent keeping the picture up. I mean, just doing the picture on the screen because you're actually writing the pixels. You know, you don't have a bitmap that's automatically getting shipped out and then you just go modify the bitmap now and then.
Right.
You have to actually physically run the raster gun as it's going across the screen and time it out right so you know where the gun is and you're changing it in real time where it needs to be. So you only have 25% of your frame time to do all your game process.
That's just wild.
So
man.
It was intense. It was intense. But Raiders, you know, I felt I really did. Now some people go, well, Pitfall, you know, look at Pitfall. Pitfall had 256 screens and stuff. And I say bullshit. I think that Raiders of the Lost Ark is a much larger game conceptually
to a player.
Because Pitfall is 256 of exactly the same screen.
With extra holes here. And an extra scorpion here, and a log maybe going here.
Right, but it's the same gameplay every screen all the way you go through.
Absolutely.
I felt I had at least three or four, maybe five separate different gameplays in Raiders. The rooms looked different. You went to different places. There were a few that looked similar, naturally. But I tried to get a real different layout map thing. You had to go one place to get one thing. You had to pick up things around the world. It had two Easter eggs in it. Because every game that I did had an Easter egg. One Easter egg was my initials and the number of the game that it was that I did. And the other Easter egg was it had the main character of each previous game that I'd done. So in Raiders of the Lost Ark, if you get into the treasure well at one point, if you have the right setup, if you've done everything you need to activate the Easter egg, you can see a Yar fly up out of it when you dig the treasure.
That's funny.
So you can see that, and then you can see...
I think I've done that one.
What the hell's Yar doing in there?
You probably have.
Yeah.
There's a Yar just flies up out of the thing, right out of the ground. And then in E.T., the same thing. With E.T., you got three signatures. Four signatures, actually. In E.T., I have an HSW-3. You got a Yar that the little flower, when you heal the flower, it'll turn into Yar once and fly out of the well. Another time, if you go on do it later, it'll turn into Indiana Jones.
That's funny.
Right, because that'll have that, and it's got an HSW-3. And so that was my thing with each game. You know, I had to have the signatures in it. And all that. The signature is never more than like 20 bytes a signature.
Right. That's just amazing to me. That's amazing to me. And now, Yar's Revenge, of course, is still selling like mad, even today on the Atari 10-in-1. I assume Raiders of the Lost Ark did amazingly.
Well, I'll tell you the truth, every single game that I ever did at Atari was a million seller. I think I'm the only programmer, possibly in the history of video games, you know. to say that, but at least for the time I was at Atari, every game I did, I was 3 for 3 with Million Sellers. 18 never made it out, but I think 18 would have done very well also.
That's floating around, isn't it?
Well, that's the funny thing is, like, you know, even, you know, Atari went out of business before, or they shut down and got taken over by Tremel and went through a total turnover and change and never actually released it, but that game still went out. So even the game that the company died in the middle of still made it out, still got released.
Right.
You know, was it a million seller? I don't know. It was never officially sold, but I can get copies of it here at the show.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
And that just kills me. You know, it's like, there's no game that I did there, even partial games, that didn't find their way out and want to get out and start circulating. And that, I'm very proud of that, you know, because I just wanted to make games that made people happy.
Yeah, you don't have to answer this if you don't want to. What kind of financial structure were you on at Atari?
Oh, we're on a royalty thing. I'll tell you about that. We were getting royalties, and we were getting like a quarter of carts, and you could divvy up, you could allocate between it. So I'd get between 10 and 15 cents a cart myself. So, you know, I made some pretty good money at Atari for a while. If it weren't for the IRS, I'd be a very wealthy guy. The IRS came after me and killed me for 15 years.
Damn.
So, but, you know, live and learn.
Live and learn.
But there was a lot of money floating around, and that money brought a lot of interesting
shenanigans.
It faced toys, drugs, sex, you know, weird games. We used to go and buy the remote control cars, just like, you know, $100-$200 remote control cars, and just play Demolition Derby with them and stuff out in the park.
So you guys were basically either wiping your butt with ones or using them to light the fire with as kindling.
Exactly.
Nice.
Yeah, it was fun, but we would do it to play weird games. You know, we'd buy expensive toys, and we'd trash them, and we'd crash them.
And would you could see video games while you were doing that?
Oh, yeah, we could always see a video game. And we were always thinking of it because that was the thing. The exciting thing about working back then was that you just wanted to make something new. You wanted to do something people go, oh, yeah.
What happened? When did all of the sudden the shift go from we can't be like everybody else to
we have to be like
everybody else? Have you been keeping with the games?
Well, I'll tell you, I mean, that whole trend started.
Was it Doom? Was it Quake? Did that start it?
Well, Doom was an innovation. I mean, you still see an occasional innovation.
You do, like Half-Life, to
okay,
me.
But the mentality among the major companies, because Doom wasn't done by a major company. Doom
right.
And this is what happens. Like, technologies get developed by upstarts.
Right.
Okay, and that's, you still have the guerrilla producers, as Nolan Bushnell would say. And that's cool. And then what happens is with the companies adopt these technologies and turn it into pablum as fast as they can.
Right.
Okay, so, and that started, you know, mid to late 80s. You know, the Atari model was a model for failure in terms of remuneration, in terms of administration. You know, Atari was a negative case for everyone in the industry. So everybody saw, you know, they paid their programmers too much, you know, they didn't work their channels right, they spread their product out too thin, too wide. And people decided it was going to be a hits business. And what's happened is the video game business has turned very much into the movie business. And in fact, the video game business wants to be the movie business. They want to put movies. Look at The Matrix, you know, getting
actual movie
producers to do the game line. Okay, well, that's okay. It's not a bad idea for The Matrix.
No.
But the fact is, it doesn't seem to attract a lot of good play. You know, people don't seem to be interested in the game that much, and they're trying to market. Because people know how to market movies, they really don't know how to market games in some ways.
A lot of people claim that movie licensing is what killed video games to begin with. What do you think about that?
I think that the only thing, nothing killed video games. You know, I mean, let's face it, games are still moving, they're selling. I'm disappointed at the fact that they sell as well as they do
yeah,
with the limited amount of games. Now, if you want to talk about what killed creativity in the game business, that's a different thing. But you talk about killing the game business, well, the game business is bigger than the movie business.
It did die. It did die for a while.
Okay, well, what happened was after Atari, video game died in 84, 85, and then Nintendo and stuff revived it, but it's never died again since then.
No, it hasn't died since. Although we are actually on the show here, we predict a video game crash. Now, it's not going to be like what happened in the 80s, but we believe that there's going to be a crash.
Well, we're seeing one kind of now. I mean, everything's way below expectations for this past year. Is it a crash? Yeah, it's not good news.
I mean, when we talk about the crash, we talk about things like product saturation, customer confusion, things that happened at that point in time when the product was, like you said, stretched too thin, too much stuff going on. Nowadays, you can go down to Walmart and basically buy 5 different incarnations of the same game. There's like 4 games. And there's 10 shelves, and there's like 4 different incarnations of 5 games apiece.
Right, but you know, when I think of an industry crash, I just think in terms of industry revenue dropping. You know, and that's not really happening so much.
For some reason, people keep buying them, even though...
Exactly. Now, that's the thing, but that's disappointing.
It is.
crashing people's perceptions and expectations. I mean, there's your crash.
And what we can't figure out is why, what happened to people's expectations? Back in the old days, you couldn't get away with that crap. People would be like, copycat, liar, you know, cheap. But now it's like, oh, cool, you know, another Doom. People are actually going out now and buying 3 gigahertz machines without even seeing Doom 3. Basically because I'm just going to buy a new machine to play Doom 3. I'm trying to figure that out.
Well, that's a license. There are some things people hook onto and they love. They just love it.
Like Mario.
They'll get whatever the next thing is, yeah. So, that's a strong license, and you know, and a company would be foolish not to play off of that. But you want to be developing the next license, too, because these things also do die eventually. Sometimes people get tired of them. If you can't keep it up, look at 3DO with Army Men. Army Men was a solid, you know, hot-selling, moving license that they turned into something people just lost respect for and weren't interested in.
Sure.
They beat it to death.
They did. How many incarnations of that did they come out with? Do you remember? It was a lot, though.
Four.
It was a lot.
I think they had like an Army Man.
$6 million worth of product.
Wow.
So, and that, you see that right in Once Upon Atari. Chip Hawkins, they had him talking about that on the DVD.
Yeah, let's just shift back. But anyway, back to the DVD for just a moment. The DVD has video clips. Video.
The DVD, first of all, the only people who were involved in it are people who were there working at Atari. I mean, I worked there and I produced the whole thing. I did all the editing, directing, all the interviews of people who worked there. I worked with. We were all there together. So, and that's so I could validate everything, verify everything, and I know what was and wasn't the story. So it's a very accurate representation. You know, you got all four episodes. I also have some extras. Now I have clips of the games. I got the rights from Atari to use their logos, games, things like that. So I have a lot of game footage in it as well. I also have pictures and clips of people from back then to compare what they look like then and now.
Yeah,
which
now
is
that's
kind of
very
fun.
Cool. That's very cool.
And as extras, I got some extra bonus footage of Nolan on talking about managing creative environments and how to do that, which is very insightful, I think, very interesting.
Yeah, considering nobody around here, nobody nowadays knows how to do that because there are no creative environments.
Exactly, and they're going to need to because I think, you know, the thing you're talking about with the crash coming, I think there already has been a crash in expectations, like I was saying. But I think people can only put up with monotony so long. And it's going to get to a point where there's going to have to be some innovation. I really believe that's true. And people need to gear up to do that. And people are not aligning themselves along those lines.
My guess would be, this is just a prediction. I like to do this every now and then because in 3 years when we're doing the show again, I'll be able to say, yeah, I was right. I predict a technology plateau. We're going to get to a point where we can't make better graphic cards. We can't make better CPUs. We're already there almost. I mean, you watch the CPUs just spike. We went from 166 to a 3 gigahertz machine. It's going to stop, and people are going to go, crap, we can't improve the graphics and sound anymore. How are we going to release our next expansion pack for $50?
Good. You're going to have an idea.
What are they going
to
do?
You're going to have to innovate creatively. You're going to have to go back and do something. There are still games you could do on the 2600 that nobody's thought of that would be great games that you'd be easy to copy onto a PS2.
Right.
Would not be hard to do anything you can do on a 2600 on a PS2, right? But, I mean, the thing is, there are real game concepts, and no one's looking for those now.
No.
Very few people. But, like, I agree with you completely when you say, you know, hey, people are just going to go, you know, it's just another cockroach. It's not fooling me. And they're going to get tired of it. And then they're going to need a new cockroach. You know, they're going to need the new thing. And then,
where are they going to draw those people from? The game industry now doesn't have anybody.
You know, they don't. They don't really have many people.
You know, even like Sid Meier, you know, those guys are just sitting on the sidelines saying, yeah, okay, that looks okay, that looks okay. I mean, I don't even think they're even participating
anymore. What they'll probably
anymore.
Do is they'll go to movies and they'll go to writing and stuff like that, and they'll find creative people, and they'll tell them, give us a concept. You know, and I'm waiting for those days.
And you,
so I want
then
to
you
be
can,
there.
You can be back in the business. So you'd like to continue doing that sort of thing. What are you doing now, professionally, if you don't mind my asking?
Well, I was a 3DO, I must say. You know, I was doing engineering management stuff where I was, you know, coordinating and managing stuff on a little higher level. I was actually enjoying that a great deal. I like working with engineers and game programmers because I can screen out the people who I don't feel are game makers.
Sure.
You know, I want to work with people who are game makers, not just engineers.
Right.
And that was good. I think I did It's a lot of fun to try and move people and try to cultivate people who are more inclined to try and expand a gameplay, try and find that extra little something to do, something that's cool on the side. And we would put extra games in our games. We would do a few little extra things that were going on, and we sort of had to fight people to do it. That was frustrating.
Now, in the old days, you guys played several roles. Nowadays, it's like a team environment. I mean, one guy may not have anything to do with some other process. You guys did it all. I mean, you guys were the engineers, you were the developers, you were the creators.
One programmer, one game. That's all it was.
One programmer, one game.
And you get everything. You get the sound, the graphics, all that stuff.
Do you feel that a single programmer that has the skill set, I'm not saying that just anybody, but a single programmer like yourself or the people in general like that can make a better game than a huge team environment? Do you think there's any truth behind that?
I think that a single programmer could, I mean, I know what you're saying. The reality of it is that a game is so big now to do a reasonable level production. A single person can't really do it. So the question you got to deal with, though, is it's a valid question that you're asking. What I hear you saying is, you know, well, hey, if you maintain a single person's vision and really be able to take that one vision and push it through and get it through, could that be a more successful game than a game designed by committee, which is the way a lot of them are coming out?
Absolutely.
Now? And I think yes. I think, you know, in a lot of ways that's true. But what it takes, it just takes a person in charge of that crew that has the right kind of leadership potential and the right kind of personality to carry people through. Because one thing about a team group is, like, you know, team think can pull things down. It can average things out to pablum and make it crap. Okay, but another way to look at team think is if you have the right people who's stimulating the group and the right people running the group, what you have is a lot of different heads contributing to one concept.
Absolutely, if they can all work together.
Right. Now, if you can achieve that, if you can get most of your people really solid behind the concept, really wanting to contribute, wanting to think about it, and you get someone who's not an egomaniac, megalomania kind of a jerk, you know, who wants everything to be just their own and that's it.
Right.
You know, then you've got a good chance, you know, because when I'm trying to design something, I want to get everything from anybody I can. I want to hear all the ideas I can.
Right.
It's not my job to come up with the idea. It's my job to make sure a good game comes together and a good idea can come from anywhere.
Right.
Okay, so if you look at it that way, a team has the potential to do a much better game than an individual, because just like an individual can assure their concept and their vision goes through, an individual can also assure that you get tunnel vision or blinders on,
sure,
and nothing else is
going
to get in. Yeah, so you can get hurt that way too. So each side has its up and downside. But I'll tell you something, as you know, it used to be a work of authorship, you know, one person doing the whole thing, you're an auteur. And now it's like you're a part of a huge team with a lot of constraints, a lot of things going on, a lot of things dragging you down and distracting you from just making the game. And, man, I prefer the work of authorship. It was a lot more
fun.
I'll tell you what.
We as the end consumer, I appreciate that kind of craftsmanship that goes in there. I think a lot of times the problem is the team is so diluted, there is no name to apply fame or blame to. You know, when you say Howard Scott Warshaw's Yar's Revenge, if the game worked and it's successful, it's you. You were successful. If it does not, you take the blame. You had a much bigger vested interest.
Like E.T., for instance.
Yeah, we're going to get to E.T. in a minute. But if you look at, like, Paul Norman, I'm not sure if you know. Oh, 10 minutes. Okay. If you look at Paul Norman, you know, he did basically, as far as I'm concerned, single-handedly brought Commodore 64 gaming into fruition. Because he was like you. This guy is a master musician, a master programmer. He's a great storyteller, and he can bring that cinematic quality to things.
And that's real important, the diversity, like you're pointing out.
But the diversity is so spread now. I mean, you've got 10 people in the music department that have probably never even seen the game that are writing music. You got the people in the artwork not only making the mats for the back of the game, but they're making graphics.
Yeah. But who's communicating to them, okay? Even though they're spread out, I mean, it's true that you have a lot of people working on it.
Right.
But the point is, who's running the show?
Right.
You actually get to a place now where you'll have people running the show who understand none of it. All they understand is how to run a show.
A show. So they're managers, but not video game managers.
Right. Okay, so you can see some of that. That's one place you can have trouble. So then you have no one unifying the concept because they don't know how to communicate to these people necessarily.
Right.
Okay. The other side of it is, you know, even though each of these people are specialists and they don't see the big picture, you can have someone who, like you were talking about, like someone else, or, you know, like hopefully myself, you know, I'm not a super expert in audio, but I know a good deal of audio. I know a lot about video production and stuff like that. You know, storytelling, just like you're saying, all these elements, these are all things that go into a game and understand the technology and understand fun. You got to be a fun guy.
Yeah, I don't think these people know how to have fun, the people that are in charge.
Some people are not really fun anymore, and that's too bad. I can never let go of being a fun guy, you know, but I'm no mushroom.
Speaking of fun, let's talk about E.T.
Because
we are short. I know you were short on time. Hopefully we're going to have you back after your keynote later on. But just in case, E.T., the game that apparently you either love or hate, and it seems to be the more people are on the ladder, I was never a big fan of the game, but I know several people who are.
I actually like the game. I actually finished the game.
Sweet.
My thought was that it was unusually too hard.
Too hard?
Okay, maybe not hard.
I thought it was too clunky.
Monotony was the problem. You're always in the hole. You're always flying out. You're always in the hole. You're always flying out.
But yeah, it's too clunky. You fall in the holes too much.
All the
time. And if I would have had as much as 6 weeks to do that game, then, you know, I might have really ironed out a few of those bugs.
How long did you have to do E.T.?
I had 5 weeks to do E.T.
And alone, again.
By myself. Yeah, E.T. was done in an environment where no one had done a game in less than 5 months or so. 4 or 5 months. Most games were about 6 or more.
So people should get off your ass because you only had 5 weeks instead of 5 months to make this game.
Oh, no, no. People should never get off my ass because I'll tell you, one thing that I know for sure that is a rule that I keep very dear to my heart is that the technical production of a game means nothing to the consumer, and it shouldn't.
Absolutely not.
So what if I did something that I think was cool or was a big feat? Well, behind the scenes, that may be interesting. But to a consumer, to Joe Blow buying a game off the cart, why should they care what went into making it, whether it was 5 minutes or 5 years? The only thing that matters is the experience they get from playing.
Absolutely.
And I take full responsibility for the fact, you know, most people did not enjoy the play experience of E.T. It just wasn't enough game there. It wasn't enough there. It wasn't tweaked enough. It wasn't tuned enough. And that's, you know, and it's true. And you'll never hear me say, oh, well, or make excuses.
No, for I would not expect that of you.
But, and that's true. The thing is, I think it was a great technical production for 5 weeks. No one else was willing to take the challenge. You know, I stood up and I was willing to take the challenge, and I charged them for it, which was also cool.
Well, let's look at it from a modern point of view. What, 18 months development on a game today?
Conservatively, yeah.
18 months, so let's look at that. Let's look at that as a ratio from how much time that you had.
Well,
five
if you
months.
Want to look at it as a ratio, this was one person for 5 weeks.
So figure, what would that relate to in modern gaming development?
About six months?
A couple of months? Maybe
I'd
2 months?
6 months.
You think well, no, that'd be half.
Well, you'd also have like 40 to 60 people working
on
the game.
Right,
it's kind of hard to compare. You know, they'd be doing a different kind of game. If you had that many people trying to do this game, you know, maybe you'd get something done in 5 weeks. But I'd hate to think of like a 40-person team working on a 2600. Ooh.
Okay, you're going to do the label. You're going to put the screw in.
First of all, you can't even get 40 pairs of hands on one keyboard. So I think that's, you know, it's tough right there.
Well, now, there's a lot of stories around E.T., and I know you've got some that nobody's probably heard in a long time. Feel free to share. I mean, everybody knows the landfill story.
Yeah, the landfill story is old news. What's cool about E.T. was the James Bond-esque way that the thing came together. Because Atari was negotiating with Spielberg to get the rights to it, and they were running late. The reason the game had to be done so quick, because they were running late with negotiations. They were running into July. Okay, and you know, if you're going to have a game available for Christmas market, it's got to be ready for production beginning of September.
So it was the Christmas market that drove the time, not the movie tie-in part of it.
Right, because they took a long time negotiating it, but they still had a hard release date.
Right.
So by late July, they closed the negotiations. They call up the boss of BCS, George Kiss, and they say, hey, we need E.T. You know, we need it done in like 6 weeks. So we need it for the Christmas market. He just laughs at him. No way. You know, you have to see that. And he goes, oh, we have to have it. You know, just can't do it. You know, can't do it. So Ray Kazar actually called me directly in my office because he thought, like, even though the boss said no one could do this, he thought, well, Howard will do this. So he just says to me, he calls up, he goes, Howard, he goes, can you do E.T. in 5 weeks? Was what it turned out. He said 6 weeks, but it was really five because it was already like July 27th.
A week into it when he called you.
And we had to have September 1st release. So I said, yeah, Ray. I said, I can definitely do it for you. So provided we reach the right arrangement.
Yeah.
And so he said, okay. He goes, listen, this was a Tuesday. He goes, Thursday morning, be at San Jose Executive Terminal. There'll be a Learjet for you.
Damn.
So I thought, yeah, cool. Oh, yeah.
Open bar, baby.
So I'm down with this plan. So I spend the next 48 hours, and I mean 48 hours, designing up the basics of what was E.T.
Damn.
So then I go to the executive terminal. They go, Mr. Warshaw. And I'm like looking around for my dad, you know, because I never responded.
Freaking limo
Warshaw.
Driver's there for you.
So they go, and I go, oh, yeah, that's me. And they go, oh, well, here you go. And there's a Learjet just sitting right there on the runway ready to
just
go.
Just for you.
Yeah, and I get on it, and there's nobody else on it. Woom, takes off. I'm thinking, this is so cool. Lands in Monterey. And as it's rolling up, here comes a limo right up to it. Out pops Ray Kazar, CEO of Atari. Skip Paul, the chief legal counsel of Atari. And Lyle Raines, who was the guy who was going to do the coin-op ET, which never got done. Because they couldn't do the coin-op that fast.
Yeah.
And, And they all get on the plane, and wham, we take off again from Monterey, because they just picked up Ray from negotiations that were closing up. Then we're going to see Spielberg in L.A. Fly down into Burbank. We land in Burbank. Wham, again, another big limo pulls right up to the plane, off the plane, into the limo. This is like the most amazing thing to me. I'm loving this. I'm loving this. And it's just, we rolled out this limo, and we're sitting there, and I'm thinking, this is so cool. This is
total
so
red
cool.
carpet treatment.
Getting the whole thing, the whole treatment. And Skip Ball is like playing with the sink. There's a sink in the limo that doesn't work. It isn't running water. And he's sitting there, and he's complaining. He's going, damn, you know, these cheap water limos and stuff.
Oh, man.
Water. And I'm thinking, I can't believe this guy, you know, is like down on the limo because the water's
funny.
Not running. You know, Jesus, if you really want it bad enough, I'll pee in the sink for you. This is so cool. So I'm just, and I'm thinking this, and we roll up the Spielberg's thing, and here we go. Now we're presenting the ideas, and I'm laying the whole thing out for E.T., And this is the second time I'm in Spielberg's office, because the first time I was there when I was just about to do Raiders, I was showing him Yar's Revenge, and I was explaining to him why he's an alien, which is a whole other story. I got quote of the month at Game Magazine for that a long time ago, when I actually explained to Steven Spielberg why he's an alien.
That's funny.
But that's another story. So it's, and then we showed him the game, and he looks at me and he goes, gee, Howard, couldn't you do something like Pac-Man?
Damn.
Like, come on,
that's got to be just a deflating thing. It's like, no. No, this is new. This is fresh.
Yes, this is innovative. This has got a 3D world on the 2600, technically.
Come on, this is a big thing.
So it's, So that's the way it goes. But, you know, and in all fairness, I do have to say that even after all the returns are counted and everything's done, E.T. was still a million seller.
Now, was E.T. ever a pack-in? I can't remember.
No, never.
It was never a pack-in.
Pac-Man was a pack-in. That's what made Pac-Man the big selling game. Because Pac-Man, when they released it, wasn't selling.
I don't understand why.
So they started packing it out. I wish they would have packed out E.T.
That might have been better.
I have a question for you.
Yeah, better hurry. He's short on time, brother.
How much time do I have left? 5 minutes?
Yeah, we got about 5 minutes.
Okay.
Will you come back?
I'll come back later, or if you're here tomorrow still.
Well, yes. Oh, hell yeah.
Oh, then I would definitely be able to get by tomorrow. For
excellent.
Sure.
Okay. Excellent. We'll make time for you.
Then you know what? I'll save my questions then.
He'll
my
save questions. His questions.
Yeah, good.
Well, the thing is, my thing is, and I'm not trying to be mean or cruel.
No, bring it on.
Do you feel responsible for the video game crash?
Hey, according to a lot of media, I am responsible for the video game crash. Am I? Am I on my own as one programmer solely responsible for the crash of a billion-dollar industry? I would love to think that's true, babe. I would love to believe that I could single-handedly bring
destroy
down a billion-dollar industry. But the fact is, you know, I think it's expectations, overbuilding.
I'd like to let you know, some of you may be wondering.
A lot of that kind of stuff is just not playing. Okay, so let me just tell you, I mean, because I think that's a really good question. I mean, I really do. But the thing is, like, you know, and this comes all the way back to, you know, did licensing. Did movie licensing killed it. Okay, well, here's what it did. It went and raised expectations of games. See, what they did was the marketing people came out. I don't want to say marketing people, because, you know, we could have made much better games, possibly. But I felt, you know, some of these games were decent games, but the fact is the expectations that the marketing people knew how to hype people up.
Right.
They didn't know how to tune them for what to expect
appropriately. Yeah, right.
So, yeah, I mean, you know, the expectations of people for what to expect of a video game, they were already marketing the coin-op games and trying to tune people up to expect coin-op quality
out of a
2600, which you can't do.
Can't be done.
Now, that's why I like doing movie licenses, because the movie licenses will have some increased expectation, but you still are free to do an original game, because I always did original games. I never did a coin-op knockoff. I never wanted to. So, but having people expect to see real coin-op quality, then having people expect to see movie quality in some ways on that, and not doing anything to adjust that expectation, but pushing it, you know, that was a problem. And I don't feel responsible for having done that.
Not personally, no.
Yeah. But, so E.T. came out, they hyped it up, is it going to be the big thing, you know? Yeah, I thought it was a game, I wanted to have emotional tone, I wanted to have some theme to it and stuff. You know, that's hard to accomplish on the 2600, you know. You got to be allowed to fail here and there, too. And if all my failures are million sellers, you know, I'm okay with that.
Yeah, but, you go wrong with that.
You know, but,
and like you said, for 5 weeks, you know, I think a lot of people don't realize that.
Well, people don't realize. Yeah, I calculated it out once. I think I produced code at an average of 13 times the industry average. That's debug working lines of finished code. At 13 times the industry average rate of production. So that's pretty cool, but then again, like I said, you can be a whirlwind and a tornado and a hurricane, and if you come out with something that people don't enjoy, you know, what did you do? You know, not much. Some people enjoyed it. You know, I enjoyed the challenge of making it. You know, And I'll tell you, honest to God, if I could feel responsible for bringing down the industry with that game, I'd be proud. I'd be proud
to say
it.
That you did it.
Because I have to say, in the big picture, you look at Yar's Revenge, which is consistently in the top two or three games on the 2600.
Right.
And ET, which is consistently in the bottom two or three
games
and things. So I say I have demonstrated great range on that machine. You know, it's like, I got the top,
I got the bottom.
You know, and Raiders, I hope, is a little over the middle.
Yeah.
You know, it's up there. And that's the thing is, like, you know, to me, that's a distinction. I just feel kind of cool about it. You know, so I never feel bad about ET. You know, I was there. I answered the call. Nobody else wanted to pick up the phone. You know?
No
pun intended.
I
phoned home.
Yeah.
You know, unfortunately, I got my mom.
Well, let's get you out of here. Thank you. This is Howard Scott Warshaw here with us at Classic Gaming Expo 2003.
Shane,
thanks so much
really
for bringing
great.
It. And we're going to hopefully have you in to tell us more stories.
I'm going to get back to give you a little more because there's more to cover.
Outstanding. Thanks so much.
My pleasure.
We want to thank Howard Scott Warshaw for his endless contribution to the show. He's also going to be hooking into our message forums eventually, giving us some nice testimonials so we can get other great interviewees as well. Thanks a lot, Howard. Don't forget to look for Howard's DVD. The Once Upon Atari, available at his website, which we will give you a link to. You definitely want to check that out. Thanks again, Howard Scott, for being on the show. Well, welcome to the Bits and Bytes section this month, ladies and gentlemen. We've got some pretty fun stuff here. We're going to try to keep it kind of short in light of how long the rest of the show is. Just a couple of things, though. First of all, it was kind of interesting. Lixang, which is a big importer of usually kind of what we would call gray items, such as flash linkers and Super Nintendo backup stuff, things like that, things that get people in trouble, it seems, most of the time, actually wrote to us and wanted to partner with Retro Gaming Radio and basically have us run spots for them on the show, and then in exchange would sell our Retro Gaming Radio CD, maybe offer us some advertising space on their site. Of course, you know, we aren't really into that sort of thing, but I thought it was kind of interesting that the show has gained enough momentum to hit the eye of somebody big like Lixang, and that was while we, of course, refused to do the offer, we were still sort of pleased that we got considered for such a thing. So that's kind of interesting. One of the posts, I don't know, it was a couple weeks back on the forums, which a lot of people don't follow, so I figured we might as well bring it up here. There is a site where this guy, I'm not even sure who the hell he is, but it's funny, compares the big three consoles. And it's really funny stuff. If you get a chance, I'm going to post the link there for you. It is some funny stuff. You'll die laughing. Even if you love Xbox and GameCube, you can't help but laugh at some of this stuff. What's next on my list here? Oh, as if it's not blatantly obvious, the voting on the forum said that you guys will take as long of a retro gaming radio show as we're willing to produce. So many of the shows this year are going to be 3 hours in length. That way we get to cover, you know, get all of the interview stuff that we got out there. And we got so much interview stuff. Plus we can keep our regular segments. A lot of people were upset when the interviews took precedence over our flashbacks and product reviews and stuff like that. So we are going to make the show longer so that we get everything in. So hopefully everybody goes for that. A couple people have brought this to my attention, and I posted it up on the forums, but I figured I better post it here live as well. Baraka was not in Ultimate Mortal Kombat 3. He was in Mortal Kombat Trilogy. Sue me for not knowing every possible incarnation of Mortal Kombat. But yes, he was in a further game other than just Mortal Kombat 2, which was the whole point of what I was trying to say. And Mortal Kombat Trilogy has all the best fighters, I thought. So Mortal Kombat Trilogy was probably one of my favorite Mortal Kombat sets, simply because Baraka was in it. Okay, enough of the Baraka crap. The Game Boy Advance has been getting a lot of attention here, of course, you know, Retro Gaming Radio, being as though we're pretty sure it's going to be the last 2D available handheld or video game console. And we just got word, well, not just got word, but it might as well be for you if you don't follow the forums. Activision Anthology is coming out for the Game Boy Advance, featuring not 10, not 20, not 30, not 40, but 56 2600 games on one Game Boy Advance cartridge. Now I'm going to run down some of the highlights here. Of course, there's a bunch of filler stuff as well. There are no iMagic games in here, which is a real depressing thing. I was really hoping to get Cosmic Ark and Atlantis, but not to be. But we do have enough good stuff in here that makes it worth looking over, including, but not
you know, this isn't the full list, folks. Barnstorming, Beam Rider, Chopper Command, Decathlon, Dragster, Enduro, Fishing Derby, Freeway, Frostbite, Hero, Kaboom, Woo! Keystone Capers, Laser Blast, Mega Mania, Pitfall, Pitfall 2, River Raid, River Raid 2, Robot Tank, Space Shuttle, Spider Fighter, Stampede, thank God, I love Stampede. Venetian Blinds, a couple of that, and that's a prototype, by the way. That's there's like five or six homebrews on there. I think it's 50 regular games and then six homebrew games. And of course, there's a whole bunch of other stuff that I didn't mention on there. If you want to see the full list, we'll give you a link. You can check it out. Apparently, this is not going to be hackable into a regular emulator. The author, which we're pretty sure we're going to score an interview with for next month's show, basically said that while it is emulation, there was a lot of special code written in order to get a lot of these games to run on a Game Boy Advance because of basically how slow it is. So don't expect to see any hacked game packs floating around, although I'm sure it will happen. I wouldn't get too excited about the concept because of the way that it was made. Another Game Boy Advance title I want to mention, because while everything's kind of gone to hell in a handbasket in the whole Mortal Kombat series, it's nice to know that they're still trying. Mortal Kombat Tournament for the Game Boy Advance features some very cool stuff. Lots of unlockables. Basically, you fight for cash. Which, yeah, of course, that's a great sign to send home, right? To the kiddies. You basically fight for coins with a K. Everything's with a K, right? Crypt, coins, etc. You do all sorts of different fighting type things. You've got your standard arcade fighting. You've got survival mode. You've got tag team style. You can practice your moves, all that other happy stuff. And as you play, you win coins. And the coins, there's a huge crypt that you go into, and there's tons of tombstones. And you can unlock these tombstones, and they do things for you. They unlock certain things. Now, you know, I'm not a huge fan of unlock, but with Mortal Kombat, there's not much else you can do. I mean, you got to learn the fatalities, you got to learn the moves, and then you're done. At least with the unlock stuff, it gives you a little more longevity with this particular title. Of course, they've tried to do the simulated 3D thing, which seems to be all the vogue, like Crazy Taxi and whatnot, these days on the GBA, which is actually kind of disappointing because the graphics really take a hit when they go to this 3D emulation thing. So, in any event, if you go to classicgaming.com, they have a big write-up about all the features it is. And I got to admit, folks, for a Game Boy Advance cart, that's pretty impressive. I'd like to bring back a segment that we haven't really talked about in a while, which is the letters to the show. We received a really nice letter from Kevin. I'll leave out his last name and his email, but he'll know who he is, who wrote to the show and said, "Hi, I'd just like to thank you guys for what you do. I try my best to never miss your shows, as they're always informative and entertaining. Got to listen to the rant. I would have thanked you in person, but every time I traveled to your booth at CGE to do so, you were always wrapped up in an interview. God, don't we know that. Also, a small bonus thank you for your August 2003 show. I was able to download it just a day or two before I hopped in the car and drove to Vegas for CGE, and it was entertaining and helped pass the time beautifully. Please, please, in capital letters, keep these shows coming. I can't wait for the up-and-coming interviews." Well, thanks, Kevin. It's nice to get a nice letter. We don't really get a lot of posts on the forums that are just, you know, "Thanks for the show, we appreciate what you do." And we kind of stopped getting emails about, you know, "Thanks for what you're doing and we appreciate it." We do get, you know, a couple every month, and I'd like to go ahead and recognize people. You know, I don't want to get a bunch of people writing in now, but it's nice to see somebody that's really sincere that writes up and says, "Hey, you know, I've been listening for 5 years and I've never written, and I feel it's time that, you know, I feel bad because I've never written." That's cool stuff, so we like to cover that. That's about going to wrap it up for Bits and Bytes. I don't want to drag it out too long. I've got a couple other things to cover, but we'll cover that next month. And until then, let's move on with the show. Let's take a few minutes to talk about the Classic Gaming Expo 2003. Now, you're going to be hearing a lot about the Classic Gaming Expo 2003 over the next 12 months, simply because we have tons of interviews for you, tons of other goodies we're going to talk about from the show. But just to give you kind of a wrap-up, just to let you guys all know what happened and why this year was a little bit different than the other years. First of all of the parts were in place this year, as they are every year. There were plenty of vendors for you to purchase goodies at. There were a few new vendors this year, which I thought was kind of nice. It wasn't just the same old people. Some people with a little bit more, that's where I'm looking for, a little more diverse selection. The show's a lot of times seems to favor Atari stuff, but we happen to get a few more extra general purpose places, like the guys across from us, the pack rat people. They gather odds and ends from just about everything. Hell, they had a 1581 disk drive in the box. I almost had to buy that just to have it, but because you don't find those very often. But we had some other people. Actually, the Prince of Persia Sands of Time people were there promoting the PlayStation 2 version of that. And Midway showed up to promote their new, I think it was the Treasures Collection, the another set of classic video games like Satan's Hollow and Moon Patrol and probably a lot of the stuff you've already bought before. And, of course, there were a lot of the regular vendors there as well. Of course, the museum was there. This year, there were a lot of new things in the museum that were not there from last year. And we got lots of pictures of that, which, of course, you can see on our website. It's funny, I don't seem to remember seeing a guard there this year, but he must have been there. He just blended in so well that I didn't notice him. Either that or I was too busy following around the practically naked chicks that were walking around. Actually, no, there weren't a lot of practically naked chicks, but that brings me to the next part of this experience of Classic Gaming Expo. Now, Classic Gaming Expo, as you would expect, attracts the lesser attractive crowd. Yeah, let's go with that. You know, the bald 30-something-ish guys, you know, we probably have a little extra weight around the old midsection. You know, the best you can hope for is, you know, a halfway hot-looking chick working one of the booths. But this year marked a very strange trend, which I hope continues. There was a considerable more amount. Does that work out? A considerable more amount? There were a lot more females there this year, and they came in all shapes and sizes. But what really amazed me was not only were there the classic gaming style women, which I'll leave it at that just because I don't want to touch anybody's feelings, but let's just say the girls oftentimes look a lot like the guys that are into classic gaming. But, no, these were actually like, you know, attractive women that you would expect to see at, say, E3, but you wouldn't expect to see at Classic Gaming Expo. And there were, like I said, there were just a plethora of different shapes, sizes of women there, which, bravo, you know, aside from throwing in some, unfortunately, distractionary functionality to the show. It also made me notice more along the lines of who was there. And again, the last couple years have very much been a very cliquish audience. In this case, however, after noticing that there were more women there than there should have been, and some of them were actually playing video games and not just dragging behind their husband that was boring the crap out of them, but there were actually young people. Now, this is something that really amazed me. And they weren't people that worked for the vendors. They were like, you know, teenagers. And, you know, I saw some couples, you know, a guy and his girlfriend walking around enjoying the show, buying t-shirts. And it's like, wow, you know, that's, you know, I don't have a lot of faith in the Generation Gimme, but, you know, it's nice to see that there's a few out there that are at least trying to diversify a little bit. So that impressed me, was the types of people that were there. What else was going on? Of course, we had lots of keynote speeches, again, as always. We were unable to attend because we were busy getting all sorts of cool interviews for you. Something else that changed dramatically this show was Retro Gaming Radio was at no lack of interviews. Basically, not only did we have full cooperation from so many great names like Howard Scott Warshaw and the folks from Electronic Games, but we had people actually coming up to the booth saying, "You need to interview me," you know? And there was no doubt that our intern definitely made the effort of running around and hunting people down for us, which was definitely useful. And we managed to pretty much keep complete full days, and it was great. That was a very nice surprise, where last year we were kind of, you know, scrounging for interviews. This year we had no trouble filling up our days and our nights. We even gave a couple of interviews ourselves this year. So it was very exciting. It was very interesting. The video game component of it, which is draws a lot of people to the show, was extraordinary this year. We had some unbelievably killer games to play this year, and I actually got a way to play a couple of them. Of course, all of my favorite Laserdisc games were there, including a working Thayer's Quest, which is just about enough to make you want to rip your throat out to play that game. But we did have some very cool games, like Narc. We actually had a working Narc machine. which was just too awesome. We had an actual cloak and dagger machine, which was tremendous. I haven't seen one of those forever. There was a multi-board Qbert game that was in there, had Qbert cubes and the original Qbert. Oh, in the future, you get to look forward to hearing an interview with the guy that made it. Very good interview. You'll like that a lot. There were also some other cool games like Super Punch-Out. Haven't seen one of those forever. Donkey Kong 3, Operation Wolf was there. Some very cool games. And if you check out the pictures on the website, you'll see a lot more of the stuff that was there. We should also have a very nice video segment, basically, of Ron Corcoran's wife running around taking a video clip of the whole show. So you'll be able to enjoy that hopefully soon as we get a chance to do that for you. Overall, it was very exciting. There was about a 15% increase in people, according to the Classic Gaming Expo facilitators. That's a good healthy number. 15% growth every year. I could live with that. Unfortunately, we're eventually going to get a little too big to fit into that convention center. And then there's a lot of us that are speculating that the show may move to another location, which may make it very difficult for us to attend and a lot of other people to attend the drive here. So we'll keep you informed on that as we know more. Let's just hope that's not the case. Let's see, what else was going on at Classic Gaming Expo? We had we did fairly decent CD sales. What else was going on? Honestly, you know, that's really the big flick items. You know, we didn't do any shopping. There just wasn't anything to shop for, especially when we managed to nail down some of these great interviews, and you're going to love some of this stuff that's coming up. I do believe we will have a full 12 months of interviews this year, and we're going to actually be combining a few of them in different parts. For those of you who are not on the forums, we actually held a poll to find out whether or not you guys would go for a 2 to 3 hour length show, and you guys said the longer the merrier, so here it is. So look forward to that the rest of the year, because I think we're going to have a whole lot of material to play for you. So that about wraps it up for the Classic Gaming Expo. I mean, I don't want to drag on and on about it. You're going to hear a lot about it throughout the year. But I did want to kind of give you a wrap-up, letting you know, of course, we had a great time. Thanks to everybody that supported the Classic Gaming Expo Retro Gaming Radio's fundraiser that we did. Really helped out a lot. For those of you who bought the CDs, that helped even more. And we had a good time, and we managed to pretty much keep everything out of pocket, which was great. Really took a load off, eased up the financial pressures of the show, let us have a lot more fun. So it was a great success, and largely was a great success thanks to you guys. So we appreciate it. Well, that's going to wrap up our Classic Gaming Expo 2003 coverage. We got so much more to get onto, so let's go. Let's get to it.
Digital Press, from Excitebike to Xbox, from Monaco GP to GTA Vice City, from Pong to Pac-Man to Pokemon and beyond, Digital Press has classic gaming covered. Check out the Retro Gaming Roundtable if you've got questions. This is the place to get answers, make friends, get more answers, ask more questions, you get the idea. And Digital Press is the home of the Digital Press Collector's Guide, with complete rarity and price listings for over 25 classic consoles. Digital Press, every console, every game, every day. www.digitpress.com. Game on.
Back before there was video game journalism, there was Bill Kunkel and the Electronic Games team, magazine team. These guys basically turned video gaming into a mainstream journalistic market. All of those people who read Amiga Format or read Amiga World or read Run Magazine, Ahoy, any of those other early magazines, you folks owe a lot to Bill Kunkel and the group at Electronic Games Magazine. These guys invented video game journalism, and they took it to a very smart, hip level, which, of course, we don't see a whole hell of a lot of today. Anyway, we got a chance to catch up with Bill Kunkel for many hours at Classic Gaming Expo 2003. And, well, heck, let's just tune on in. This is Shane R. Monroe at the Classic Gaming Expo 2003. I'm here with Bill Kunkel, one of the original founders of Electronic Games Magazine.
There you go.
I got that right. We'll have to edit that, though.
Well, there were about five variations, actually, after we came out. Within 6 months, there was every, you know, variation you could come up.
Absolutely.
Electronic Fun and Games.
I remember that one.
So, yeah, there were a lot. But and speaking of which, Games Magazine didn't like us calling ourselves Electronic Games. They made us make the word electronic much bigger than the word games.
That's funny. So we've kind of run down a little history offline. Let's go ahead and go through again give us the progression, the Bill Kunkel history from then till now. What's what you've been involved in, so they get a very good grasp of what you've done.
The whole thing?
Yeah, just got real quickie deal.
Well, a quickie start is in 1906. I was never a game player. I never played cards. I wasn't much on board games or anything. And in I guess it was 1970, I ran across a Pong machine, 70-71, at an arcade. And I was transfixed. It was the first time I found a game that spoke to my soul. I mean,
it was a life-changing experience.
It really was. It was an epiphany,
I understand the concept completely.
And so my first wife and I immediately ran out and bought the original Odyssey.
Wow. You still have that original Odyssey?
Actually, I donated it. It's, I believe, in the museum next door.
That's great.
We played that. We bought a lot of the hardwired systems that came out in the succeeding years. But in 1978, the big break happens because the 2600 comes out and the Odyssey 2. Now, we were real good friends with Arnie and Joyce, Arnie Katz and Joyce Worley Katz, Arnie's wife. And they had just bought an Atari 2600. So we thought, we should buy the Odyssey 2, and then we could see all the video games in the world. We did this, and we said, we had a connection up at a magazine called Video Magazine at the time. And we went up, saw the editor, Bruce Apar, and said, "Bruce, what about a column for video games? I mean, now that we've got these programmable systems, it's going to be like VCRs, They're going to be making tapes for these things."
Right.
So, there'll be more software. We had no idea that this was true at the time.
Right.
We were totally talking through our butts, but we figured, hey, maybe, right? If we're wrong, who's going to know? So they said, okay, do it. We started a column called Arcade Alley, which ran in video until, I guess, around 1982, 83. And by 81, the game thing had exploded to such a point that we were able to sell the publisher on a strictly games magazine. The idea was it was going to cover everything. It was going to cover coin ops. It was going to cover handhelds, video games, computers, anything that was electronic and was a game or an entertainment device. And they said, okay, we'll do it. We'll put it out as a quarterly. That way, we can leave it on the newsstand. If it takes 3 months to sell out, whatever, that's
sure.
Okay. They put it out, the first issue, and they were getting calls back from, at the time, there were newsstands. They were getting calls back from newsstands and distributors saying, we need more. Now, at the time, the only time distributors ever call publishers and ask for more copies of a magazine was if, like, Jackie Kennedy was doing a nude spread in Playboy. Okay? So this is a pretty remarkable thing. And at this point, they figured, we might have something here. So we immediately, with the second issue, were bi-monthly. By, I think, the fourth issue, we were monthly. And we, for the first year almost, we kind of ruled the world, I mean, Arnie Joyce and I were game journalism, When we went to CES, there was nobody to kiss up to for all those PR people but us.
I mean, you must have gotten so much free crap that it's not even funny.
We were in heaven. Hey,
God, please take one of these.
I mean,
take two of them.
Take two shirts. We got, the only other people who were giving them out to were distributors, and they
right.
They were in the entertainment business. They'll be press. Well, the Daily News and the New York Times weren't showing up. Okay.
Right. Yeah.
And if
yeah.
they were, they were going over to see the VCRs and the television sets.
Right.
And the phones that look like pianos and all those other wonderful electronic items, which eventually caused the split and the creation of E3 because the video game people, having come in late on CES, were always treated like the redheaded stepchildren. And they were being put in circus tents in the back and things like that.
Damn,
that kind of hall.
Oh yeah, it was totally disrespectful. But
wow.
CES said, "Look, our policy is that our first customers get the pick of the spots." So you'd walk into the front of this enormous show, and it'd be all these cheap electronic gimcracks, just little crappy little things that were going to break in 20 minutes, And out in the circus tents in the back was Sony and Sega and Nintendo and all these other guys.
Yeah.
And they said, "We're not going to put up with this." So that's how E3 got started. They decided, well, we'll do our own show.
Wow.
And other than going to Atlanta for 3 years, they haven't made many mistakes with that show.
Yeah.
That those 3 years in Atlanta, though. Oh,
I heard
man.
That was hell.
Oh. No knock on Atlanta, but don't ever send me there again.
No, don't mince words. Tell us how you really feel.
Yeah. I mean, it had all the disadvantages. It was hot. It was uncomfortable. There was nothing to do. At the time, Atlanta was the murder capital of the United States.
Classic. Perfect place to put a game show.
It was just horrible.
But wasn't the year they pulled out, wasn't that the year of the Olympics, though?
Yeah, well, they didn't want to be there with that because that would have just been... Remember, one of the big problems for these shows, especially then, was broadband. Uh-huh. Getting, and if the Olympics is there, you got ABC or NBC or whoever hogging every bit of broadband and telephone space in town.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, many's the time I went to a early online demonstration of games and they couldn't get online.
Oh, man.
So... It was a very bad... Plus, everybody there said, look, there are no game companies in Atlanta, okay? If you had it in Chicago, there'd be companies there.
Right.
If you had it on the West Coast, there'd be companies there. If you had it in the Northwest, there'd be companies there. But there's nobody here but Coca-Cola. So why are we doing... And it was just that they got a sweetheart deal, and it was an offer they couldn't refuse because it was so cheap. So they made a mistake for 3 years.
But see, I heard rumors. Every couple of years you hear a rumor that they're going to go back to Atlanta. Have you heard that too?
I hear it. The expression in one ear and out the other.
Right.
I no more believe they will ever go back to Atlanta.
You guys just keep talking.
I mean, they'll be in Amsterdam before they're in Atlanta. And I'll be there. There's nobody there. I mean, if some of the people are there, it's okay. But when everybody has to tote all that equipment
all the way over
into a city in the
crazy.
Middle of nowhere in terms of electronic media and new technology,
sure.
I mean, Atlanta is not exactly one of the cities you think of when you think of high tech.
No. You think it's damn hot.
It just doesn't make any... if they gave them the city... In terms of the bad will that it would create, I think they would be crazy to even consider it.
So, anyway, continue with your history.
Okay.
We got sideswiped there.
Well, I'm giving you the quickie version now. In 83, 84, as everybody knows, there was a tremendous crash. And the video game market collapsed. And at that point, computers moved in to take what little space was left. And... there were terrible changes going on at the magazine. We had a sales rep who kept saying things like, you guys use words like fun way too much in your magazine. There was an actual perception at the time that games were like bad things. They were old things. We had moved beyond games. Now that we were playing on such marvels of technology as C64s and VIC-20s, we should be doing something more important, right? We should be doing simulations. So instead of a game where you flew a jet and you blew a bunch of other jets out of the sky, you got a combat simulator. But they didn't stop there. Oh no, they didn't stop there. There were simulations of dairy farms. There was, situations of doing things. To me, a simulation should be something skydiving, right? Flying a plane, something that you would like to do maybe in real life, but it'd be very expensive. It'd be very scary. It'd be very inconvenient.
It's an escape thing, not something that would make it like work.
Exactly. I don't want to sit there and plow the fields virtually.
We're doing the North 40 tonight. Log in.
Tonight, get my guy out there and fix some cotton, That doesn't work.
What's the fun in that?
But it was a simulation mania. And like we could see, the magazine every month was dropping in ads because companies were dropping out. There just weren't that many companies to advertise. And you couldn't run the business deal we were on. To give you an idea how successful Electronic Games Magazine was, we started in the winter of 81. The first issue was, in fact, winter 81-82. By 1983, early in 83, we were down right near the Bowery, downtown Manhattan. Our bosses were able to buy the penthouse floor, the entire penthouse floor of the Grumbacher building in New York, which is on 34th Street and 10th Avenue, right across the street from the site where they were building the Jacob Javits Convention Center, to give you an idea of the location.
Right.
They paid cash and got it.
Wow.
And made an agreement that they would fix all the gargoyles and stuff that were, you know, hanging around the top of the building, all the masonry and all those repairs, that they would take care of that too. They spent millions, and they had millions from this magazine. And wow. I had an office to die for. I mean, you know, if they put me in charge of sewers in Las Vegas, and we don't have sewers in Las Vegas, and they put me in an office like that, I considered a job. It was, you know. It was a wonderful deal. I had a sliding door out onto a patio overlooking the river. It was just beautiful. And then within a year and a half, it's all gone. You know, the whole thing. And the perception at the time was a lot of the retailers were saying, you know, it is a fad. This is hula hoops.
Right,
this is
right.
Technological hula hoops. And so the minute the sales started dropping, their perception was the fad is over.
Right.
Okay, start selling these games for $2 and, you know, get them out. And the minute people start seeing these games selling for $2, they're like, well, how good can a game be if they're selling it for $2?
Exactly. Perception of value.
The market died. Now, of course, a lot of that was an illusion, because through all those years in Canada, companies like Activision were quietly making tons of money selling their 2600 games. Atari was quietly selling tons of 2600 systems. People were still buying them, but in America we had the brain set that the compute, that, you know, the game systems had been the doorstop, the foot in the door, and now we had moved on to computers, and there would be no reason to go back to these game systems again.
Right.
So, 86 at CES, Scott Orr, who was president of GameStar for Activision, did all their sports games, started the Madden franchise, all those. He comes over to me and says, Bill, you got to see it. It's the greatest machine at the show. It's called the NES. It's this company, Nintendo's got it. I go over and look at it, and I see a little robot picking up blocks and moving them over. And I went back and I said, Scott, whatever you've been smoking, can we go to your room and do some of it? And he says, I'm telling you, this is going to be huge. And I said, you're nuts. Who's going to buy a robot picking up blocks? Well, see, he saw what I didn't see. He saw the system underneath that stupid robot. And the minute they dumped the robot, and as you know, I was right, Nintendo failed.
Nintendo who?
Who?
Exactly.
Who?
So
Mario who?
That all of a sudden, there's an interest in video games again. And we had been writing for Analog, which was one of the many computer magazines, and Ahoy, which was a C64
right, yeah,
magazine.
Ahoy.
We were writing for them to stay alive at the time. And we had begun designing games. Interplay had given us a chance, basically saying, put your money where your mouth is. You guys have been criticizing our games here for 3, 4, 5 years now. Let's see you do something. So we started designing games, and over the next, well, I still design games, and well, as Subway Software, we probably did, I don't know, 20 games, you know, over various systems over the next bunch of years. So that helped fill in the dead spots when the magazines weren't going. But Analog sold out, and Lee Pappas, who owned it at the time, took Andy Eddy, his editor, and they moved over and they started video games and computer entertainment. And they took care of the video games, ironically enough, and Arnie Joyce and I did the computer coverage. So it was kind of like a split magazine for a long time. We did that for about 4 or 5 years, and then we met, I'm blanking on his name, Sendai, the guy, Harris, Steve Harris. And I ran into Steve, and we had a very pleasant conversation, and the next thing I know, we're in negotiations with my agent to restart Electronic Games, because the title had fallen into public domain because it hadn't been used in 8 years. So we restarted Electronic Games magazine at that point, And that carried on. That ran for another 4 years or so. And after that, you know, it was websites and new magazines here, there, and everywhere. And basically, you know, consulting, anything they'd pay me for. You know, this was, I love doing this. This is what I knew. And I wrote strategy books. I, you know, like I said, if there's a way to make money, other than programming, if there's a way to make money in this business, I've done it. I'm even teaching classes in game design at UNLV here in Vegas. I live here. So it's worked out great, and I'm still here. After 1978 to 2003.
You're still here.
Still here.
Still working it out. What would you attribute, since you were like in the bowels of this whole industry?
Nice term.
Thank you. I like the term bowels.
It works.
God, I gotta go to the bathroom. the video game crash, you would attribute to what? If you could say, like, in two sentences, three sentences, what caused the video game crash from your perspective?
As with most things, it's not just one thing. It's never
of
just
course.
One thing. A lot of it is what I talked about before, the retailers' absolute belief that this was a fad, that this was Pokemon, that this was Beanie Babies, that this is Cabbage Patch Dolls, that this had run its course, and it was over. And we were
What started that mindset?
Well,
you can see the progressive fall, but what started the initial, it's over?
What started it was, remember, Nintendo always said, we learn from the mistakes of the past. And they did, and that's why they've been a successful company. And the mistake they saw that Atari made was Atari did not control the third-party software market in any way, shape, or form. And as a result, the market was totally flooded with bad games, mediocre games, interesting games, but were in fact unplayable.
Right.
And all it takes is spending $30, $40 on a game that absolutely eats it. And your interest in buying more games for that system starts to die. The next thing that happened was Atari said, well, we've got to go to a next generation technology. And Americans had been looking at it like, excuse me, since 1978, we've been amassing these software collections, and now you're telling us these games, we've got to throw them out and start rebuying them in this new 5200 format? Then, of course, there were the joysticks on the 5200, which I won't even get into.
That's shooting the other foot.
Exactly. So, with Atari out of the picture, there was nobody strong enough to carry the market.
Right.
Coleco wasn't strong enough?
Coleco started off like a house of fire.
Yes.
Yeah, what happened to Coleco?
And
Adam.
Well,
yeah, good point.
A lot of it was personnel. They lost Mike Katz. When Mike Katz left as president of ColecoVision, they lost one of the most visionary individuals in the history of this business. And that kind of loss is very... How do you make up a loss like that? A guy who knows everything about the business, has been in the business forever, and really understood it. And suddenly Coleco... I mean, you realize they were originally the Connecticut Leather Company.
I did not know that.
Yes, that's where their name comes from.
Yeah, they used to make shoes.
They made swimming pools and luggage and stuff like that. Now, what are these guys? If you go into the museum and you look at some of their early hardwired games, they produced some of the most incredible, grotesque monstrosities. The ones with the light gun sticking on one side, the steering wheel.
Oh, yeah, yeah. They still have some of those in the museum.
God, it's like, you know, it's a wonderful, freakish exhibit at a museum. But as a retail item...
Where do you market something like
nightmare.
That?
It's a nightmare.
Where do you put that? Do you put five on a shelf?
Exactly. And then, of course, Coleco had this little project you may remember called the Atom.
Yeah, we're intimate.
There you go. Well, I won't speak about former lovers, but you probably heard, the first time they showed the machine at a CES, it was in fact an Apple II. Underneath,
oh, I never knew that.
I heard
about that.
Don't sue me if there's anybody still alive at Coleco, but that was the word
They used to run Macintosh demos with Amigas underneath the counter.
It was a very common bit.
That was
because they always had those little podiums that they put the games
right,
on,
right.
And it'd be this big empty thing underneath. And I was like, oh, we just got a couple of plugs down there, a couple of surge protectors. You know, there's nothing else down there. You know,
right.
You know, meanwhile they had NORAD. You know,
the Whopper was underneath there playing the games.
I'm not sure.
Oh, too funny.
So, I think you know those things kind of came together. And people said, you know, I'm going to have to buy a new system every 3 years, every 4 years. Computers are happening. They're becoming expensive. They're becoming accessible.
And
remember, we had people in the game world in those days had no technical comprehension. I mean, we knew that the Atari 2600 was a 2K system.
Right.
Okay? They eventually got it up to 4K. They eventually got it up to 8K. But, Lord Almighty, the Apple II was 48K. Boy, that would have to be like 10 times better, right?
Yeah.
Well, more for
games. Show me the game.
But, you know, the game would come up, it'd be ironic. The game would come up, and you'd see this beautiful introduction screen.
Right.
Static introduction screen. And you think, oh my God, my dream has been answered. And then we go to a football game that's X's and O's on a black and white grid.
Okay for you, but
and you're like,
okay, I need to make sure.
Oh, hell.
Oh, no.
What did I do?
Can I get back my Atari 2600? And in those days, those computers, I mean, the first Apple II Plus I ever bought cost like $2,400. So those are not cheap things. So, you know, it was a convergence of stuff, and it was only when Nintendo, a company from another country, said, why wouldn't people want the convenience of something they could plug into their television, sit around the television, play as a family if they wanted to, you know, and they don't have to wait load times and read these complicated instructions, pop it in, plug and play. And suddenly, plug and play became the catchphrase for the late 80s. You know, that after years of horror on those computers and playing those terrible PC versions of Sega coin-ops and other monstrosities, the Nintendo was a wonderful little machine for people. And it suddenly, people said, wait a minute, video games could actually be a staple. Video games could be something that will sell forever, you know. And once again, they were actually on the nose on this one. And you know, they as you probably have noticed, they haven't gone away since. But in 1984, you must understand, it looked very different. It looked very different to the business case. It looked like they had backed something, and it was time to pull out now. It was time to know when to hold them and to know when to fold them, and it was time to fold them.
Do you think, based on, are you still doing video gaming related journalism now?
Not much journalism. I write for Joe Santulli's site, the digital press site. I do a column for him. Most of what I do is design work when I work in the field. I teach a course in game design at UNLV and several courses actually, and I'm actually in negotiations right now for a company about to make games for the Engage system from Nokia, and I worked for Westwood when they were here in town before they moved out to the West Coast, before EA moved them out to the West Coast.
Right.
Those were my buddies, you know. Brett Sperry and Lou Castle were two of the first guys I met when I moved out here from New York in 1989. And at the time, they were in like a two-room office in a strip mall. And, you know, we helped introduce them to Virgin, some guys from Virgin. And Virgin bought them, as you know, and they went on to become one of the most successful companies in the business. So while they were here in town, you know, I would work for them. But I haven't progressed. See, I haven't moved ahead to the next generation. I don't own an Xbox yet. I don't own a PlayStation 2 or a GameCube. I was going to buy them, And I went out and I started playing the game. And I said, I'm sorry, these games are not better than the kind of games I like. Okay, hockey games, sports games, wrestling games, first-person shooters. I had better games or games that were just as good on the N64. I mean, I play GoldenEye to this day, and I haven't found a game that satisfies me more than GoldenEye, or even The World Is Not Enough on the new system. And until I do, I'm not going to buy one.
It's the must-have system.
Right.
The must-have game, the killer app.
There is, exactly.
And I try to explain that to people, and they're like, what are you talking about? All the games are good. And it's like, no, they're not good.
It's got to be the game. It's Space Invaders, did it for the Atari 2600. Well, Pong, of course, helped. But remember, there had been Pong games for 8 years. It was Space Invaders and then Pac-Man that cemented Atari. It's about the games, you know? Like I said, it's about the economy. It's about the games. And if you don't have that game, I mean, there's no game out there that I got to have.
Right.
I mean, I was considering buying. I donated my Coleco and my ColecoVision and my full set of Coleco games years ago, and I was almost going to buy a new Coleco.
I'm about to say you want it back, don't you?
Because somebody's got a copy of Ladybug, and I'm like, I want to play Ladybug.
Have you thought about emulation?
Well, that's what I'm going to do. You
okay,
know? But I mean, the idea of playing it on the original controller,
yeah,
you
yeah,
know. I mean, that's appealing.
That's something that cannot be emulated.
No.
It's a crappy-ass Coleco controller.
That's bad as it was.
That hand cramp.
Hey, you know, and I mean, honestly, to me, on Intellivision games, emulation is far superior, because that was one of the worst controllers in the history
Thank
of the world.
Thank you. I was trying to tell somebody that.
My thumb bends backwards to this day because of that thing.
You probably know the answer to this. We were arguing about this on the way up here. Why did they use the disc? It wasn't it because it had like 32 directions?
Yes.
That's what I thought.
Yes. But now, and this is a really interesting point you bring up. Games, the whole paradigms that drive games are really, if you think about it, driven by the control devices. Now, the early games, a joystick and one button, okay? You're holding the joystick in your left hand, you're moving the stick itself, you're holding the base in your left hand, you're moving the stick with your right hand, and you're using your thumb to press a button.
Right.
That means the primary assignment is to your right hand. So the games were directionally oriented. It was about moving to different places.
Right.
When the Nintendo controller came out, they flip-flopped it. And the direction controller was moved to the left side, so it could be controlled with the left thumb. As a result, they were only up, down, left, right. And it was all about pushing buttons, and the timing and the pushing of buttons.
Right.
Which was why I love the N64 so much, because of that analog option, that analog stick there in the middle. But at the time, it was all about movement. And all the Atari could brag about was we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 directions. That was it. You could only get 8 directions. Well, you don't need more than 8 directions on a 2K video game. You really don't.
Yeah.
But in television, their goal was we got a top Atari in every way.
That's right. More has better, to equal better.
Better graphics, our licenses. I mean, I'm sure that Auto Race sold a million more copies because it had a USAC license attached to it. Nobody even knew what the USAC was. But they were anal about getting those licenses on there, the big name licenses on it. And everything had to be better. And so now they could say, we have a controller. It has all these buttons on it to confuse the hell out of you.
More buttons, more directions.
More stuff on the side, and 32 directions, you know. And, you know, what am I going to sit there? I'd like to move 43 degrees to the northeast. It was totally ridiculous. And it's, again, ergonomics, you know. Why did Atari put out that 5200 joystick?
Somebody was smoking crack that day.
Why would you... A non-centering joystick. What? I mean, there was a stick that had come out early on called Le Stick.
I remember Lestick.
You remember Lestick? Mercury
do.
Switches.
I do remember Lestick.
And the idea was that it was just a cord and like a pistol grip.
Right.
And theoretically, if you went like that, it would. The problem was, how do I know I have it centered? How do I? It's rolling. The thing is rolling all over the screen. I've got to keep my hands steady. I need a drink. You know, it was insane. I mean, and everybody was used to that joystick wanging back to that neutral central position. So they always knew we're starting from the center. Okay, I can go right, left, up, down. With this thing, it would flop over to the left, and the thing would keep moving to the left. And oh my God!
The only thing I can think of is that somebody over there was thinking, this controller works so awesome for X kind of video games. That's what we're going to do. We're going to make X kind of video games. But I don't even remember a video game that would make
that
use,
took use of it. No, I agree.
It's well, like somebody had the fatty, they lit it up, they put the torch to it, and they said, oh, hell yes.
I think it's a crime to blame that on marijuana. I think we're talking about malfunction of the human brain. Even drugs can't explain.
Crack cocaine, though.
PCP, I won't even buy.
Oh, man. You can't even get heroin to go that far.
I can't. I absolutely cannot. I cannot justify the thinking behind. I mean, there's a thing called ergonomics, you know? You bring people in, you let them. I'm sure that.
How does your hand feel? Feels
exactly.
Good.
You know, this is a terrible joystick. There was nobody came in there on those. If they did actual testing,
maybe they didn't do
said,
the testing.
Oh, I love this. You know?
Or maybe the CEO's son said, hey, Dad, can I have this kind of joystick?
Well, there was another thing. The early Apple joysticks,
those were analog.
Were analog, but they had versions where you could unlock them.
Right, you could let them flop or you could let them flop.
And some computer jerks liked the being able to just flip flop all over the place.
I hate it.
And somebody must have been one of those people. You know, like the people who shop at Radio Shack, you know?
Hey, that was one of those people.
Hey,
all I can think of is I'm doing...
You were able to break the control. That's what counts.
I'm playing F-16 Strike Eagle. I got to itch my ass. So when I take my hand off the control, I got to leave it to the left so I can bank while I'm itching my ass.
That's correct.
What other purpose can you find with that?
Those are issues that are generally not considered in the design of a joystick, but should
right,
be.
But, you know, I agree. You know, I think there should be some method. That's why they put a pause button on joysticks.
That's
so that you
correct.
Can itch your ass while you were playing.
That's
I'm
right.
a big believer in that.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
So we get your basic feeling on modern-day consoles. You're kind of like us. We played
Show
on the
me
Dreamcast.
Something I gotta have, and I'll get it.
We played on Dreamcast already. We played it on. You played it on N64. We played it on PlayStation. Why should we buy again?
What did you think of the Dreamcast? Did you ever get one?
Yeah, Dreamcast was a very nice machine. At that point, Atari was doomed. I mean, Sega was doomed, I should say.
Yeah.
And you know, it was just a matter of time. I mean, it was a wonderful system. I was a big Sega fan. I mean, as a member of the press. Nintendo did not treat the press well.
No way.
Really?
No. Nintendo did not treat the press well.
Well, they didn't really need the press.
Exactly. Nintendo had Nintendo Power.
We
were their competition.
Oh, no wonder they didn't love you.
In the minds of a lot of the executives there, not thinking that
why
it's better to be
that?
Covered in five magazines than
yes.
one, except they totally controlled the content in their books.
Oh, man. This game is excellent.
Oh, there's no such thing as a bad Mac game in
no
Nintendo
such thing
Power.
As a bad
You'll
game.
Never read a bad review.
You'll never hear them say, Mortal Kombat sucks. You'll never see that.
Plus, remember, Nintendo, in avoiding the mistake that Atari had made, Nintendo said, look, well, we're going to totally control the cartridges that come out. Because we're going to sell them to them. We're going to make them buy the chips from us. So... Let's say Nintendo was going to do one of their half-assed sports games. And
damn.
I'm going to do a good sports game
wow.
on the Nintendo. I got a license with them. I got a right to do it. And they tell me, sure, you can make 10,000 units. Well, Nintendo's going to make 10 million units.
Right.
Excuse me. What the hell chance am I going to stand out there?
Yeah.
You're going to put a zillion bucks into advertising. You're going to get Ken Griffey to show up at the home of everyone who buys it. You know, they own the Seattle Mariners, for God's sake. I mean, you know, it was ridiculous.
How can you compete? You can't compete.
You couldn't. They were stacking the deck. Of course, on the other hand, they control. If a game came out that was mediocre, well, you're not producing that many of them because we're not going to have a bunch of crummy games cluttering up our market and destroying it. And that's why Nintendo was able to keep their systems alive longer than anybody else.
We have a listener who gave me a bunch of questions, Bill. He gave us a bunch of questions, and I left the questions at home, and I feel really bad. But one of his questions that sticks out in my mind was, did you know about the Atari Nintendo thing as it was happening?
Which Atari Nintendo?
When Nintendo came to Atari and asked Atari to market their system, or you didn't find out until that CES when you saw the actual Nintendo?
I had heard that a Japanese company, I did not know the name, but remember the name Nintendo didn't mean anything, you know.
You didn't think Nintendo Donkey Kong?
No.
I've always been like that. When I used to hear Nintendo, I used to go, oh, the Donkey Kong and Popeye guy.
Exactly. Sewer Sam. You know? The one where Mario's brother goes through the sewers there, Luigi there.
Yeah.
I mean, their games are not that. I never thought Donkey Kong was a good video game.
Really?
I never liked Donkey Kong.
I love Donkey Kong.
And I love
Mario Brothers.
Other than the Zelda games, I'm not that big on those Nintendo games. But I mostly like the third-party games that are produced from like EA and companies like that on the Nintendo. But we had heard that, you know, of course, you must remember at that point, rumors were coming in every day. You know, they're talking with some Japanese company that wants to make a video game machine. At that point, that seemed about as likely, you know, of happening as, you know, us landing on Venus. You know, it just didn't seem like it was.
It really sounded that crazy to you.
It did. It seemed like it wasn't just going to happen, you know. And then they, you know, that CES, they're there. And they created an impressive stir, but they didn't overwhelm the show. I mean, people didn't walk out of that show going, Nintendo, Nintendo, Nintendo.
That came later.
No, exactly. People walked out saying, it's interesting, we'll see.
Well, that's peculiar.
And I suspect that was the attitude of Atari at that point, because Atari didn't need another failure, especially one that wasn't theirs.
Yeah.
They had enough of those.
So you mentioned Electronic Arts. I gotta know, because you would probably know, when exactly did they sell their soul? Because Electronic Arts owned so much ass in the early 80s, then all of a sudden they turned into this horrible, money-grubbing, crappy game by John Madden Football again and again. It's the same game with an expansion pack. What? When did that happen?
When that happened was...
Did management change? Did somebody buy out?
Yeah. Well, of course, Trip Hawkins. Now, you know, when you're talking about EA... You're talking about Trip Hawkins. You're talking about Bing Gordon, who's still there, I believe. But Bing was I won't insult him by saying a bean counter, because he was much more than that.
Right,
but
he was a
business guy.
Understandable.
And the visionary there was always Trip Hawkins, a man whose name I envy so intensely that if he ever puts it up on eBay, I will buy it. And remember, he left to get into 3DO.
Right.
And write the greatest IPO maybe in the history of this industry. In terms of making money on the quick. But they lost that. And any company that becomes too successful, power corrupts. Absolute power corrupts absolutely. I think if you were looking at it from the point of view of the consumer... You would see that they went from a company that was producing software, it looked like record albums. You'd open them up, they'd have the folder.
Yeah, like Archon.
They'd have all kind of material. They were marketing the developers.
Oh, yeah.
They were marketing the developers like they were rock stars.
Right.
Everybody knew who Free Fall was back then.
Exactly. Games like Archon and
Bill Budge's
stuff
Pinball.
Like that, and Seven Cities of Gold.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, those were masterpieces. Mule, I mean, you know.
Almost everything the EA touched was gold back then.
Magnificent
stuff.
They
could crack in a box and put it in there, and they could sell it, and it would work.
There was one game that flopped about a construction worker or something.
But oh, Hard Hat Mac?
Hard Hat Mac, yeah.
That did flop?
That did flop.
That did well on the Apple, too, I
it
guess.
Did really, yeah, I was going to say it was really popular on the Apple.
Well, it certainly did.
They probably made money on it.
Well, yeah, but yeah.
Not what they were making on
pinball
construction set.
You would say that in the same sentence, you know.
Yeah, and when they suddenly they decided, oh, this format of packaging, when they stack it on the shelves, they don't stack it wide. They stack it like an album. So people are just seeing the binder. Okay? Well, fine. Change your format. But at the same time, they stop marketing their creators. And this is one of my biggest gripes with this industry. How you can have an entertainment medium that does not use the creators to market its game, to market its product, is insane. Could you imagine Stephen King writes a book and it just says, by Stephen King? You know, never wrote anything else. You know, well, in fact, the book says, by somebody. And if you turn to the very last page, and you get a magnifying glass, it'll say, content by Stephen King.
It's 3 pages forward, 5 pages back.
Right.
Look up in the third paragraph, his initials like freaking
that's his first name appears there.
Yeah.
Then
right.
You have to go to page 148 and
paragraph
to get the
three.
King.
Yeah. That's funny.
Freaking Easter eggs
that's
and books.
That's a very interesting point because we were talking about that earlier with some of the Atari guys. And in the early days, Atari did not want anybody to know who was making games. They wanted Atari games to be Atari, not David Crane, they didn't want people.
That's how Easter eggs started.
Exactly. So they wanted an entity. But then all of a sudden, we talked to David Crane last year extensively, and basically, you know, it's like, aren't you sad that they took David Crane's Pitfall and turned it into this, what the hell is this Mayan adventure crap? I said, they took something that we trusted, David Crane's name. You know, like you said, they were marketing developers, and people were saying, David Crane means quality.
Yeah.
When I see David Crane, I don't even have to look at the back of the box. I just pick it up and walk off with it.
Right.
And then, like you said, they stopped doing that.
Yeah.
And we stopped getting intimate. I liked knowing who was making the
games. I mean, would you go out and buy a book that was a Western, and it was published by Ballantyne, and that's all you knew?
Right.
Would you go out and buy a rhythm and blues album, and all you know is it's from Atlantic?
Right.
Oh, Atlantic, they're a good company. I'll buy this.
I'll just buy that.
You know, how many times have you seen on, with the exception of people like Sid Meier, a couple of guys, you know, who have met Will Wright, guys who have broken through on that incredible level of success, how often do you see by the creator of on a video or computer game?
Oh, you don't.
You don't.
You don't see it. And it's nuts. And you know what it all stems from? It stems from that early on paranoia that Atari had after they lost those guys to Activision.
Right.
It was like, well, if we let them know the names, then they'll hire them.
Yeah.
Like they couldn't find out the names, right? There wasn't anybody sleeping with anybody in Silicon Valley that the entire valley didn't know about. But you weren't going to know who was developing Yar's Revenge or whatever for Atari. And really what they did, you know, you've heard the expression, they closing the barn door after the horses have run away. Well, what Atari did basically was, after the horses ran away, they had a few mules and jackasses left, and they put up velvet wallpaper. I mean, not to knock Howard Warsaw, but I don't think the man ever developed a game I would play. I mean, you know, I'm a very nice man, but I hate his games, okay? And I mean, Pac-Man was, talk about factors that killed, that caused the crash. Pac-Man, the hype that was built up for the 2600 version of Pac-Man, and then that blinking monstrosity came out. You know,
I'd say that Pac-Man was probably responsible for more epileptic seizures than Pokemon ever was.
Ridiculous.
Did you guys pretty much, I don't remember even reading a review from your magazine about Pac-Man. I remember reading about Ms. Pac-Man. I don't think I ever saw a review about Pac-Man. You guys
review. We probably did review it.
It was a very short paragraph expression.
I can't imagine that we would have avoided reviewing.
But the thing is, you guys, the first magazine, and I'm pretty sure this is offensive, the first magazine I've ever seen really slam games was Electronic Gaming Monthly.
Right.
You guys were more or less like, if it sucked, you just pretend it never came out.
Well, I'll be perfectly honest with you, that when we started, we didn't even know who we were writing for. We didn't know. There was no demographic studies of who were playing these games.
Right.
Are we writing for 7-year-olds? When we finally did demographic studies, we found out our average reader was like 21, 22. But we didn't know that. And as the first magazine, it was our mentality that we had to be kind of cheerleaders for the industry. And while we weren't going to tell you this game that sucks is great, we were also not in a great big hurry to make it the lead review and tear it apart for 2 pages.
Right.
We were more interested in telling people about the games that were out there that would be, that might excite them and might interest them. And the EGM was able to grab off, and to their credit, they were able to grab off a lot of the younger readers who love that bashing style, you know?
Right.
But young people hate. That's just the way it is.
But they also started another paradigm that I still see in the magazines, which is like, it goes like this. The game or the game system that's a year away, that's still in development and is a year away from being released, is phenomenal. It's the most incredible thing that ever existed.
Yeah.
The game that's out now, there's no this mode, there's no that. I conquered that game in 25 minutes. And of course, another thing that killed I just couldn't stand was all those platform games. And the idea that you started at a fixed point, and you reached a fixed point, you conquered 7 bosses, and the game was over.
I don't like games that end either.
You know, I like games that go on forever, that you can just keep playing and keep playing and keep playing. It's funny, with a lot of the handheld systems now and things like that, you're seeing a lot of return to the simpler game paradigm. And I was saying last night to someone at the dinner, isn't it remarkable that no one has ever used the play mechanic of Missile Command again?
Yeah, it's weird.
There's been a couple of knockoffs, though.
There's been, like, Liberator,
Never been another game. I mean, just what was the game that knocked off Robotron? Smash TV. You know, just like Arkanoid took Breakout and took it to the next level. Right. Nobody ever took
Missile Command to the next level.
And took it to the next level.
Liberator doesn't count?
Liberator?
Atari's Liberator? That was
kind of a next generation attempt to do it. But I'm talking about like later on, you know, like in the 80s and the late 80s.
Or just
doing
a better version.
Yeah. I mean, it's a great game.
I think what happened with that? Excuse me. A lot of shareware people did it. It seems to be like a proving ground for shareware authors, and the first game they ever do is a really bad knockoff of Missile Command. There was one that actually did it all in 3D, which was almost cool.
Really?
You could look at it from the side, but then you could like roll the mouse and it would take you to a top view, and then you could go back, and basically the missiles were all three-dimensional. So, I mean, you actually had to like launch and... I'm not a big fan of direct 3D ports of classic 2D games, but this was like, well, that's kind of cool. But you're right.
What game was that?
It was in some stupid ass 4-pack with a bunch of other games that were just.
I would like to play that.
It was like, whoa, that's kind of a cool idea.
It's also interesting the obsession that developed with 3D.
Yeah,
we were talking about that in the last interview.
You know, you did all these platform games, and Sonic the Hedgehog. Okay, now we're gonna take Sonic Crash Bandicoot or Sonic or whatever, and instead of having him move real fast across these cool play fields, we're going to have him running into the distance over bridges.
Wait, you forgot isometric first.
Oh, yes.
Got to do the isometric bit.
Yes.
And then we do the third person.
I found this is not an improvement. This does not make the game more fun to... For me, it does not make the game more fun to play. It's just you can do a new trick, so you're showing me the new trick.
Technology, proof of technology demo.
That's what you got today. And in fact, you know the big gripe I hear about modern games from, you know, the grumpy old gamers? You know, the guys sitting around, nowadays the balls were square, and we liked it, you know? The complaint they have is, where are the games I can sit down and play in 10 friggin' minutes?
Hey,
there we go. See, we got something else.
Where are the games? Why do I have to sit down, read a novel, and then spend 4 weeks getting to the point where I can play?
Turn, explain why we need to... He swears. He writes, we have a forum. And he says, you have an hour minimum on each game.
You have to play this for an hour minimum before you'll like it.
Before you like, we played it for 20 minutes, it sucks. He goes, no.
No, you got to least an hour.
You don't know it's good until you've played it for at least 4 days.
That's Final Fantasy.
Well, there is a difference. I mean, there's certain games that you play for 10 minutes, and I like a lot of those games that you play for 10 minutes, but there's other games that I like having to
SimCity. I mean, if you played SimCity for 10 minutes, you're not going to accomplish very much, and yet if you dedicate time to it, you can have a lot of fun. And I'm not across the board knocking.
I totally agree with you. I totally agree with you that there are very little games that you can play now.
But, yeah, I mean, just give me something. Just throw me a bone,
you know? Yeah, you don't get the bone.
You don't.
You know where you get the bone? You got to go to, like, CNET downloads and grab some. I mean, you have to wade through, like, 1,000 of them to find anything that's cool. I mean, then you find the gems.
Yeah.
But it's like, but then you're back to the same thing. If I wanted to play a game for 4 hours or look for 4 hours to find a game to play, I still out those 4 hours.
I spend as much time on sites like Netives.com playing games like Marbles.
Oh, yeah. You know, Bejeweled. I mean, I can completely understand why Bejeweled works.
Oh, absolutely.
Nobody wants to dedicate 5 hours of their time.
Beautiful, simple games. I can go in if I'm waiting for something to load. I can play it, and when the game's loaded, then I can finish and go back, and I haven't missed anything, and I had fun. And it's a genre that's not there anymore because it's like not worthy. I mean, do you think they could sell Tetris today? If somebody walked in off the street, other than the Game
Tetris.
Boy.
Yeah.
Original Tetris, you walked in, you couldn't sell it.
Right, but yet it's made so much cash. It's existed for what, 20 years?
20 years almost.
In my opinion, it is the greatest electronic game. I feel it meets all the definitions. You could not play it in the real world. It could only exist in a simulated environment.
Right.
It meets my definition of a minute to learn, a lifetime to master.
Right.
You can play it for 5 seconds, or you can play it for 5 days, and it's still fun. And the closure you get when you complete a row and they disappear, it's one of those, people ask, what is it that's fun about that game? And I'm a pretty articulate guy, you know, but there's no words to describe what it is that makes this fun. It's a visceral thing, you know. It's like responding with my brain and my synapses and my memories in a weird way that's making me feel good. And that's what I miss.
I still think there's subliminals in there, personally. It's like they figured out a way, clever-ass Russians, leave it to them, they figured out a way to basically give you crap through the screen. They basically give you an addictive drug absorbed through the eyeballs via a computer.
I think you need to be re-educated, comrade.
You were playing these Tetris. You play now.
No. Do you still play Pac-Man?
Do I still play Pac-Man? I don't still play.
Really?
But I'm going to get a main version of Ladybug. I absolutely.
Ladybug is the bomb. We played that on ColecoVision days and days.
Oh, just turning over those letters, pinball aspect.
I'll tell you what. You know what? That was the most brilliant thing they ever did. And you could is the stupid extra letters.
Yes.
And changing the colors and changing between
and the
words
special styles.
And extra. Exactly. Yeah, you for once could control
the shape of the.
See, that it'd be like Pac-Man where you could change the maze at will. It's exactly what that is. It was one of the first games I ever saw that gave the user the ability to change the play field on demand.
Right.
And then they did it again with Mousetrap.
Yes.
But it didn't quite work as well.
There was just, again, it's that inexplicable quality. But Ladybug just, and the music, you know, it's the entire sensory experience. Would Pac-Man have been as successful without that silly music? Yeah. I don't know. I think it might have been, but I don't know.
Some things appeal to people on a level you cannot quantify.
Right. It's not verbal. It can't be verbalized.
Yeah. I think with Pac-Man, it was the right game at the right time.
No question. No question
that
about
was,
that.
Yeah, perfect marketing.
People needed an addiction.
Yeah.
And that helped fill the gap.
And how about the fact that the guy who developed Pac-Man got so badly screwed over by Namco that he never developed another game again?
I never knew that.
Oh, I didn't know that either.
They paid him the equivalent of about a $10,000 bonus at the end of the year. After the game, it probably made them $50 million, you know.
Still making the money.
Still making money.
He walked out the door and never developed the game again. Talking about a lost genius. I mean, that would be like Ernest Hemingway wrote his first book and the publisher sent it back to him. And he said, you know, well, I guess I'm not a writer, you know, and walked out the door. I mean, we lost a genius. It might be another Miyamoto.
God only knows,
you know?
Yeah, who could have came up with that.
You know, maybe he was a one-trick pony. I don't know, but
that was a hell of a trick.
Do you think if Namco made a console, it would probably kick everybody's behind right now?
Could Namco do it now?
Namco probably could do it now. They probably have enough money. They probably have enough name, you know, credibility in the industry.
I'd be interested in that.
I don't know that. I mean, you know, there's already a new next generation game system out there that's very good. I've had a look at it, but they're having a hell of a hard time selling it. Yeah, I'm blanking on the name. I'll dig it up for you, and I'll tell you. I'll give it to you tomorrow as we do part two.
Once again, we'd like to thank Bill Kunkel for giving us his endless time and endless bits of wisdom. And Bill Kunkel is actually a member of our message forum, so definitely go pop in there and say hi. I'm sure he'd appreciate that. I'd like to take a couple of minutes to talk about the new game from Buena Vista Interactive called Tron 2.0. Now, normally I don't talk about modern games on the show, but when modern games have a delightfully retro theme, and it actually ties into a classic computerish cult-style movie like Tron, well, sometimes we just have to talk about stuff like that. So we're going to give you kind of a mini-review about Tron 2.0 and hope that you guys can fashion a good opinion about the title. You could probably guess that I wouldn't be talking about this title if I wasn't impressed by it. You're absolutely right. No need to promote modern gamage unless there's something worth promoting. Now, I've got to tell you, after looking at the screenshots before the game actually came out, I had to say, oh, first-person shooter, denied, derezzed, offline, end of line. But there was something compelling about it that I just had to take a look. If nothing else, just to give me something to crap on, because I'm not happy if I'm not bitching. And this looked like a perfect opportunity. Another first-person shooter, bring it on. But the fact that it tied to Tron made me even want to hate it more, because Tron is one of those eternal things that you don't mess with. It's just the simple fact that we never got a perfect arcade translation for the home computer or the home video game marketplace pissed me off enough. But now we've basically digressed Tron into a first-person shooter. I was looking forward to firing this game up and beating the crap out of it and then blasting it on the forums. But since I actually found something enjoyable about the title, I figured I would talk about it here. Tron is indeed a first-person shooter. There are moments during the game when you change from your first-person perspective and you move into things like the light cycles, which is as far along as I am right now, so I can't comment, but you can actually go to their site, which we will provide you a link to, and you will see all of the masses of other stuff that you get to do. A lot of the game is standard first-person shooter-style stuff. Go from area to area, get stuff that opens other stuff that lets you get other stuff that opens up other stuff. Now, normally that would be a big, nasty slam down because, frankly, that's like every other first-person shooter that's been out there. They also did not adopt, fortunately, the standard every weapon in the Quake arsenal gets a Tron equivalent. We did manage to get a ranged weapon, which is your disc, and you also got a gun style weapon, but you don't get a whole lot of ammo with that, so you'll be spending most of your time using your disc, which is exactly what you should be doing in a Tron game. Screw giving me a frickin' BFG gun in Tron, okay? There's discs. I don't even think there was a gun in Tron anywhere. So let me have my disc. Give me the power to make the disc do what I want it to do, and we'll be happy. They also had those stun rods. You get to use that as a weapon, which, okay, that's from the Tron universe. I'll buy into that. And basically that is your quiet stealth weapon, sort of like the old slip the knife in the back routine. But what is the basic point of the game? Well, the basic point of the game is you are dragged into the game. You're Alan One's son, by the way, Jet, which I guess the movie would have been based on had they decided to go forward with it. I guess the sales of this video game will decide whether or not the game, the movie version of the game, basically gets made. Basically, there's something wrong, and the computer's in a problem situation. Boom, you're zapped into the game, and you begin going through training missions if you so desire. Now, what's really nice is they kept a lot of the atmosphere about the game. What about the graphics? Well, the graphics are okay. In fact, I've got it running in like 1024 by 768 in the highest resolution possible. And it still suffers the same fate that every other game suffers from that's polygon-based. It's got rough edges. It's got very definitive texture patterns, things like that. And, you know, you're just not going to get away from it. And it's still going to bug me till the beginning of time. You know, I used to enjoy nicely drawn 3D sprites. But I guess we're beyond that now. We've got to take some steps back and enjoy polygons. Now, the lighting effect works pretty well. They did manage to recreate that pretty well, although it's not quite the same. It's like it's too fake. You know, you just can't quite buy into it, but it's close enough for the game. The training situation is handled by a bit, or in this case, a byte, the big brother of the bit, which was kind of nice to have some familiar faces around. You did get a shot at seeing Alan One at the beginning, voiced by Bruce Boxleitner, which was kind of nice to have him officially involved with the project. Anyway, so you get in there and you start doing some training missions. Basically, not even really training missions. You follow the bit around and you talk to people and they tell you stuff. Now, here's what's really nice. They spent a lot of time working on the usability interface of the game. Without this usability interface, folks, the way that you manipulate things that you have, without this, this would have been another first-person shooter, and you would not be listening to this right now. But instead, what they did is something very, very clever. They took and they made the internal system, your own personal inventory system, something actually clever for a change. You start off by gaining information, which basically gets shoved into a journal, okay? So you can go back and look at this journal anytime, and it's nice and neatly laid out, point-and-click style, with topic headings and the whole bit. So it's like you're building your own help file as you go. And you can always refer back to it. Then they start leading you through working with items. It's interesting. You basically have a memory core that has a certain amount of slots to it. Now, your memory slots, which are basically your inventory slots, fall into like combat, defense, and utility software. Yes, that's right. You load software into your memory banks. Now, as time goes on, this gets a lot more convoluted, but try to bear with me. You start off with fragmented memory, which is something that I didn't really feel I got from the help file well enough. You actually have to select these memory modules and drop them into the defragger, and then continue playing. And as you play, the memory will defrag, and once it's defragged, that memory slot becomes open and available for use. Well, you got like, I think like 6 or 7 slots to begin with. As you move around throughout the game, you will pick up programs. Now, some programs are designed to work inside your system, in which case you can simply activate them by dropping them into your memory slots. Other programs have to be converted or ported over to your system. The whole thing oozes of all the computer geek crap, and us computer geeks, even if you're not really hot on the game, you're going to have to say, okay, this is pretty cool. So you have to drop the program into a converter, and of course, it's just like your defragger. You've got to wait a certain amount of time for that to get ported. You also have different versions of the software. Now, you may pick up an item that lets you jump higher, right? But it may be an alpha version of the jumping program. As you move on, you may find a beta version of the software program, and you can upgrade what you have on board. Your programs can get infected with viruses. You may have to antivirus or repair your software programs to get them to work. There's also what they call permissions. And permissions are what base your basic keys, folks. This is the keys of the first-person shooter empire. Sometimes it'll take more than one permission, and they actually have like a joint permission system where in order to unlock this particular door, you need a certain set of permissions, in other words, different colored keys. But how fast you can download these permissions varies. So as you're walking around, let's say you whack a bad guy with your disc. Now, he's going to have a core dump, which is basically his whatever he had on him when he died, right? Standard FPS stuff. You go there and you search the core, and he may have permissions on him. Or he may have an object or a program on him that you can assimilate into yourself. Now, most of the time, there's, you know, kind of bogus stuff. There's some energy, maybe. You have two different kinds of energy matrix. You have health, and you have energy. And you can actually use energy in some interesting ways. Some items you can actually over-surge with energy from yourself to break them open. Some things you have to transfer energy in to make them work. It costs you energy to download software into your system. So you're constantly working in energy slant health system, right? Which is actually kind of cool. Of course, you can only imagine what sort of missions they can wrap you around here. So you spend the first part of your missions running around grabbing stuff, getting permissions, getting software, defragging your memory, basically getting yourself ready. Once you actually start getting into the missions, there's a couple of stealthish style missions that I've been through where you can't like alert anybody. You have to actually destroy some things to make other things happen. In the mission sense, the game is still very much FPS, which of course is great for the other 99.9% of the world that seems to love FPS, even if there's nothing different about them. The disc that you get to throw around is really cool. You can actually control it to some extent, and I guess there are actually power-ups to give you more control over it. But just as you're starting to kind of get into the mold of this whole running around first-person style routine, the light cycles come into play. You actually get to play on the light cycle grid. You can get a special energy rod that gives you a better light cycle. The one thing that they do kind of deviate a little bit is they give you power-ups on the light cycle grid. They have slow and fast zones on the light cycle grid. If you've played Armageddon, however the hell you pronounce that, basically the definitive 3D light cycle game, you'll be very comfortable and familiar with this game. You can move the camera around, you can speed up, you can slow down, and the enemy AI is pretty good. Until you actually really start getting used to the game, you'll get your ass kicked a lot. But it's fun getting your ass kicked for a while. And by the time you're starting to get tired of getting your ass kicked, it somehow clicks in and you're actually able to play the thing. Now, whether or not the AI is getting dumber to help me out, hard to say. But even if that's just the case, then the programmers did a good job of keeping the game level. If you derez on the light cycle grid, you get to try it again, so you're not really dying every time. One other thing that I will say about the game, other than what I've talked about so far, is the fact that they get you in and out of the game very quickly. Once you've actually loaded the game up, F5 will do a quick save, F9 will get you right back into the game, and there's nothing that really keeps you from enjoying getting back into the game. It's not like you have to go through a bunch of screens and crap. It's just, oh, dead, go right back in. Dead, go right back in. So that was a nice plus. Maybe we're actually finally starting to get to a point to where people have a little bit of care and thought, and they're not just trying to exercise the latest engine. But this game actually, and again, like I said, for people who love first-person shooters, you're probably going to like this. This isn't a deathmatch game, folks. There are puzzles to solve. There are things you have to do. You will not be able to win this game by being a mindless FPS roaster. Okay? You will have to go in and run programs. They make you do it. You know, if you want to get past this area, you're going to have to install this program. You're going to have to port it over and install it, whatever. The whole thing oozes of an environment that is enveloping. And that's really hard to do anymore. Especially the fact that it happens to be something that you're familiar with, the Tron universe. It talks a lot of computer geek speak. So things that you're sitting there going, oh, this is cool, this is cool, this is like, this is totally computerish, I love this. And it starts to draw you in. And again, the system requirements, I'm running a P4, you know, 2.26, I'm running, you know, a GeForce 4 MX card, and I'm able to run it at 1024 with full textures and detailers or whatever. And the gameplay is really smooth. The combat's actually fairly fun. There's a couple different ways you can fight. And like I said, the sound, the audio and the ambiance and the music, is spot on. As Brian said, good use of samples, yeah, but there's also something to be said with the how to use the samples. It's not like you can just throw samples in the game and make it work. They have to be done right. And in my opinion, Tron 2.0 was done right. To kind of keep this short, I was hoping to keep it under 15 minutes, and I'm going to keep it under 15 minutes. The truth is this is one of the few games of the modern age that I will actually put the Shane R. Monroe stamp of approval on. The last game I put my stamp of approval on was Grand Theft Auto 3 and Grand Theft Auto 3 Vice City, because I felt there was a little ingenuity there. Tron also has some ingenuity. For those of you who are familiar with the genres of light cycles, the genres of first-person shooters, you're going to feel at home. For those of you who are looking for maybe a little more interaction, not a terrible blast fest all the time, this game will probably appeal to you as well. The game is already out and on shelves. Probably if you've been interested in it, you've probably already played it. If not, hopefully this will give you an opportunity to get someone else's opinion on it before you go out and spend the cash or grab a demo. So that's Tron 2.0, created by Monolith Software, distributed under Buena Vista Interactive. Let me know what you guys think. Tell us on the forums what you thought of Tron 2.0. There'll probably be a forum on it by the time the show comes out. Well, folks, that's going to wrap it up for this edition of Retro Gaming Radio. Special thanks go out to Howard Scott Warshaw. Buy his Once Upon Atari DVD now. It's available on his website. You'll have a link to it right there. We also like to thank Bill Kunkel for his endless contributions to the show, and he continues to do so on our forums. If you'd like to speak with Bill Kunkel, he's actually on the Retro Gaming Radio forum, so definitely check that out with a lot of other very smart, fun-to-be-around people. Special thanks go out to speedhost.com, of course, for being our regularly scheduled hosts. And thanks to all the listeners for tuning in. This, our fifth year of Retro Gaming Radio. We'll see you all next time, and keep it retro.